lunch, so keeps us happy.
For program development, here at the Chemical Heritage Foundation, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the spring 2001 Early Bird Talk. I don't know where that name came from, but I guess it's good. Today, our speaker is James Fisher. He remains son of Chester Fisher, the founder of Fisher Scientific, and the collector of the wonderful painting, the Brain, and the Pasteur artifacts and memorabilia that are known as the Fisher Collection here at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Jim Fisher was associated with Fisher Scientific for approximately 40 years. Fisher Scientific internationally generously donated this amazing collection, and Jim was instrumental in arranging the gift, for which we are very grateful. He will now provide us with background on the company, on his father, the collector, and make comments on selected work in the collection. I am anxious to hear his presentation, as I know you are. Thus, please join me in welcoming Jim Fisher.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. I have a knee which is a little bothersome on standing, and I will be at the reception later, and that will be standing, so I didn't want to do both. So I apologize for sitting down. It's just simply a matter of necessity. I also apologize for having scheduled this call last fall, this talk, and a minor medical problem intervened, and it had to be postponed, and in a few minutes you may wish it hadn't been rescheduled. I will allow, I swear to John, some time at the end for questions, and I will quit on time, and I will be at the reception, and that's my word. A couple words of acknowledgement. The staff here has been superb in taking this collection and reconditioning it and hanging it and building a wonderful gallery for you all to see it. And it's named for my late father. And if you have not seen it, I hope you will either following this talk or the reception or both, or if not, at another time, because it is a wonderful collection and very interesting. And the second wonderful acknowledgement goes to the company with which I no longer have any attachment, any affiliation. And Paul Montrone, the chairman of the board, with whom I became very friendly in, how shall we put it, negotiating the gift that came here, and in addition to making that magnificent gift on the part of the company, that he also made a sizable, or had the company make a sizable cash donation to help us mount it and stage it. Arnold Thackeray, your boss here, has asked me to talk briefly about the history of the company because it spans the century. It was started in 1902, and although it's no longer a family company, it spans only two generations, because Chester founded it as a very young man, and I'm 81, so we span an awful lot of time. And that's rather unusual, because a 100-year-old company, it will be 100 years next year, is usually third generation, if indeed it survives at all. So it really is a look at science in America, and to some degree the world, because the laboratory business so closely parallels the growth of technology and science. My dad was keeping things nice and symmetrical, was the class of 00 at the University of Pittsburgh, and was 20 when he graduated, and founded the company a year later. He was a mechanical engineer by graduation, and he had no mechanical ability at all. He couldn't drive a nail. He had trouble with his shoelaces. He really was not mechanical at all. However, in deference to that, I should mention that he fathered four children, all boys, and exactly 4 years apart within 30 days. Now, the women in the audience will get that significance immediately, and the men can figure it out on the way home. One died in infancy. All three finally ended up at one time or another in the company. In 01, he was under the porch and heard a bunch of business friends of his father talking about, and they were all in the industry. Pittsburgh was an enormous center of industry. The problem of getting laboratory supplies and equipment. There was a source in Chicago. There was Eimer and Amann, two good German names, in New York. There was Arthur H. Thomas here in Philadelphia, and a few others. Problem, it took 2-3 weeks. The Pittsburgh Testing Laboratories, then local, now international, commercial testing laboratory, the referee test to which you sent samples, make sure your own lab was honest and correct, said, boy, it's a pain in the neck because they borrow stuff from me. They're my customers. So I got to lend them a case of test tubes until their shipment comes in. Then I had to keep track of who owes me what. And said the man, I just wish somebody would have a supply house here in Pittsburgh. Bingo. So, in 2002, he starts the company. He wasn't of age. He couldn't incorporate. He had to be 21 in Pennsylvania, in most states at that time. Borrowed a few $1,000, opened with two employees, and the company was born. When he and mother were first married, and they moved in several walk-up flats, Mrs. Fisher would say, my mother would say, Margaret would say, Mrs. Jones, what does your husband do? Oh, he's a dentist, or he's a banker or something. How about you, Mrs. Fisher? He's in laboratory supplies. Of course, everybody heard it as laboratory supplies and couldn't wait to be invited to take a look at the bathroom to see if there was something very special. Everything was imported. There was no industry to make all the stuff that goes into laboratories. It was all from Europe. Everything was imported. And the major importer was a firm in New York that had been established in 1851 with those two good German names, Eimer und Amund. And they had, because they started out by speaking the language, agents all over Europe. And by George, you had to go through them to get a lot of the porcelain and glassware and chemicals and every other thing that a lab would need. And they gave my dad a very meager little discount. And he didn't have the agents established, but he got along and he made it. Quietly, he resented what Eimer und Amund was doing to him. And he was not a vengeful man, but in 1940, he had the quiet revenge of buying that company. Edison was a very good customer of Eimer und Amund, Thomas Edison, and he was a cut-and-try non-scientist. His idea was to try everything. You remember there were 700 or 800 things he tried to make the light bulb. He never did make a very good light bulb. The carbonized bamboo filament was very fragile. And Eimer und Amund made the pump that pumped out the air to make the evacuated tube into which the filament glowed. And it glowed. So Eimer und Amund, as they say in baseball, excuse me, Edison, as they say in baseball, got credit for the win. By the way, he was bought almost everything because it was a cut and try, and he never paid his bills. And when we bought Eimer und Amund, I went through the old books, and Edison owed us hundreds and hundreds of dollars and never paid us. And we never could collect it because when he went to talk to him in New Jersey, he hid in the closet under the bench. He's a crafty old guy. World War I cut off the European supply completely. As Dad said, the Kaiser turned the valve, and there was nothing coming in. And therefore, an industry was born in America to make the equipment, supplies, chemicals, glassware, instruments that you need in a laboratory. And it was born. And Corning made the glass. They were making something else. And Bausch and Lomb were making binoculars. They switched to microscopes, and so on it goes. So all of the stuff that goes in that was somehow filled in by the ingenuity of American industry, aided by the Kaiser. The old-timers said, wait, you wait until the war is over, we will all go back. But they didn't, because the industry was not only making a substitute, but making things as good or better. And about 1920, Dad began to collect. He began to collect alchemical and historical pictures. It was a personal interest, and he owned the collection himself for decades. He thought that the laboratory scientist was not given enough recognition. And this was a way to show the heritage and to honor the people in the laboratories, the men sort of behind the scenes who make so many other things possible. And this was a way to help them. And he published a little publication which he wrote himself for 20 or 25 years. And when I went with the company after World War II, I wrote it for 10 years. And it had a general interest article and an alchemical picture on the front cover. It was looked very non-commercial, but it was commercial to the teeth. And in behind the lead article, which was of general interest, there were a list of, guess what, new products. And it was very successful. In fact, it was so successful that many people, when we discontinued it, protested and said they hadn't been billed for their circulation and they'd let it lapse. And please renew their circulation. Now, that's the definition of a completely successful external house organ. The company grew, and the lab world grew, and people began to take recognition of what, indeed, laboratories meant. In about 1937, a an eminent British chemist named Sir William Pope, who had collected a wonderful collection of alchemical and historical pictures dealing with the history of science, died. And his estate came up for auction. And Dad had the amazing sense through an agent to bid. And he bid just right. And he bought the collection. In 1939, the war broke out. And the telegram came in from the agent who was packing up this priceless collection, which would double Dad's collection. Should I ship? Of course, the German submarines were all in the North Atlantic, and ships were being sunk in a woeful manner. And Dad had the sense to say, ship it. And they shipped it, and the ship was torpedoed and survived and limped back to port. They repaired the ship in another telegram. Now what should I do? And Dad had the sense to know that if the British scientific public ever woke up to the fact that this perfectly marvelous collection was being taken, guess what? By the Yankees again, he would never get it out of Britain. And he said, ship it. And it made the trip. And it is a significant part of the collection, a lot of which is on view at the Fisher Gallery, which if you haven't seen, you certainly should. You'll enjoy it. During the war, laboratories certainly came into their own, and we all know about the things that they made. In the Fisher Scientific Company, I was not with the company at that time, we had an army officer in the offices of the headquarters of the company, watching every incoming shipment notice from our suppliers and our own factories. And he had a great big stamp that said AAA-1, and that meant the priority went to where the army officer said it went. And he would walk over and go, bang. I visited there once during the war. And there he was in uniform, and he would bang that stamp, and that meant that those balances that people had been waiting for went to where he said. And guess where a lot of it went? To a place called Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And it went down there by the carload. And the people in the trade called it the bubble gum factory, because the astonishing thing about Oak Ridge was, to us and to many other suppliers, was that everything went in and nothing ever came out. So why not bubble gum? Of course, what went out weighed about a pound. It went out at night, and it went to Los Alamos, and the rest is history, because that's what they were doing there. Finally, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the then President Truman announced about the bombing and about the surrender of Japan, and I quote, "We have won," meaning the United States, "we have won the battle of the laboratories as we have won all the other battles." Now, the truth is, America did not win all the battles, although they won the war. But the word was headline news, and to those of us in this kind of business, to have that kind of publicity and recognition for what laboratorians, as that word Dad coined, meant a lot, because all of a sudden people didn't confuse it with laboratory. I joined the firm after the war. One of the standard training procedures for my two older brothers was to write a catalog. I managed to skirt that somehow. That's a heck of a job. By devising, and not too long after I went with the company, a two-year catalog instead of the old 10-year cycle. The 10-year cycle meant you had to start to write all over the catalog. It's alphabetical, and by the time you got to B, something in A had changed, which is a form of insanity. And so I said, let's put out a 2-year catalog and make it condensed, and we will knock the socks off competition. And boy, we did, because the little guy couldn't possibly do it. And we bought 15 or 20 of the small companies over many, many years. This business is bizarre. It's a strange business. Dad always called it the man behind the gun. In World War I, for example, there was a field gun, a 75-millimeter, that's 3-inch field gun made in America. And the War Department, which we now call the Department of Defense, put a full-page ad in many newspapers and said to people all over the United States, who can make a little gun sight to put on top of the gun so we can shoot this gun if we ever get it to France? Dad had about 12 people in the manufacturing shop. He tore out the ad and he went down to the Mellon Bank, a very large bank, and there sitting in the middle of the room, Andrew Mellon, later Secretary of the Treasury under three presidents and a genius, was sitting at a desk in the middle of the floor with a chair beside him. And he knew my grandfather slightly. Chester, how are you? Sit down. How's your father? Well, thank you. What can I do for you? I see this ad. He looked at the ad. Flags were flying. Irving Berlin was writing the over there, over there. There were stars in the window if you had a son. And it was patriotic. And Andrew Mellon looked at Dad and he said, Chester, I have only one question. Can you do it? Chester was about 38 years of age. Yes, Mr. Mellon, I can. Mr. Mellon reached into his vests. Everybody wore a vest those days. Pulled out his business card, wrote the $10,000 on the back that he wanted to borrow, and said, Chester, you take that over to the window, where there was a man with a green eye shade, of course, and they'll give you the money. He walked over, pushed the card under the window. The man with the sleeve garters and the eye shade gave him a receipt, and thus we had the money to buy the machines, to make the gun sight. It was the only gun made in America that saw action in World War I. When the Germans released poison gas, General Black Jack Pershing, in charge of all the Allied forces, burned up the wires. What were they to do? What kind of gas were they releasing? Because if you don't know the gas, you don't know how to make the gas mask. Was it mustard gas? Was it chlorine? Was it whatever? And Dad had a few people making gas analysis equipment. He had them and others work around the clock to make the gas apparatus that would analyze them. Built crates, which later could become a laboratory bench by turning them upside down. Put urgent War Department and a lot of other flirty stuff, which he made up, all over the crates. Dispatched two men who had never been out of Pittsburgh in their life to ride with the crates in the train and in the ship. And they set up the analysis in France, analyzed the gas, and they knew what to put in the gas masks. Talk about man behind the gun. This is a fascinating and strange business, and I'll give you just a couple of tiny examples. When I was just joined the firm after the war, I went out to the School of Dentistry with a local representative and met Dr. Jerry Cox, the dentistry school of part of the medical complex of the University of Pittsburgh. And Jerry Cox was working with the fact that he had been sent by Aluminum Company of America to go to Texas and find out why the cattle around an aluminum plant had wonderfully strong teeth, as cattle often do, but they were mottled. They had little black marks in them. He found out that the cattle had been eating the shrubbery and grass and everything else around the aluminum plant, and they used cryolite, sodium aluminum chloride, to melt the aluminum. You need it for the aluminum process. And they ate up too much fluoride, and their teeth were mottled, but boy, were they strong. Dr. Cox said, ha, ha. If we put small amounts of fluoride in the drinking water, we can practically cure caries, fissures, holes in kids' teeth down the years. Today, 75% of the drinking water in America has the proper amount of fluoride in it. Not too much, because they get mottled. But dental caries have declined to the point where dentists are going into cosmetic work, as you'll notice, and kids' teeth are infinitely better. Just one aspect. I sat on a stool at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, and a young man named Jonas Salk told me that he had it licked. There wasn't any question. The University of Wisconsin, paid by the FDA, was testing his vaccine, and it would be announced very soon. But he said to me, there's no question about it. Our vaccine works. Polio is licked. A year later, it was announced, and Salk became a national hero. He was a lovely young man, liked him very much. When that happened, he got a little bit big for his hat. On the other hand, he was a brilliant man. In New Jersey, a salesman took me to the Bell Labs when Ma Bell was the phone company. And I went to the research labs and sat on a bench and talked to Dr. Bill Shockley. And he had big jars with hot salt solution all over them. Guess what make they were, I was pleased to say. They were being stirred. And I said, what are you doing? He said, we're growing crystals. I said, it's very interesting. Saturated salt solutions. And he said, I found that some of these crystals, when you take them out and dry them and put them between two pieces of metal, they'll pass current in one direction and not the other. Oh, I said, having been a radio ham in my youth, that's a halfway rectifier. Exactly, he said, astounded that anybody in the sales department could make a comment like that. And I said, furthermore, if you make a triple savage, maybe you can put another piece in between. You'll have what amounts to a triode, because they're like a grid in a triode tube, which the British call a valve. and you could take the place of a vacuum tube. He said, we've already done it. And, of course, it was the transistor. Such is the kind of things you get into in this screwy business. Today, I think we take for granted the fact that laboratories are such an important part of our lives. I made a tiny little list on the plane. Our health, our safety, our science, our education, our crime detection, our metals, our plastic, our building materials, our medicines, our water and sewage treatment, our air quality, everything is touched by the laboratory. So, the old man had a heck of an idea. I'm going to say a few words about Pasteur. We have in part of the collection Louis Pasteur, who was a chemist and not a physician, although he is widely known as a physician. And it's part of the collection, but space does not permit showing much of it, except one notable item I'll mention. He was the founder of the science of bacteriology, which did not exist, and it was not created by a physician, but by a chemist, appropriate for the room and building we're in. His work on optical isomers, we have in the collection, not visible, are wonderful pictures of the optical stereopic pictures of tartaric acid, both levulo and dextro, which you will see. He saved, he of course a Frenchman to his fingernails, he saved the silk industry because the silkworms in southern France ate mulberry leaves. And by George, the mulberry trees got a disease. And he found out the microorganism that caused it and cured that microorganism. And the mulberry trees flourished and the silkworms flourished and the silk industry was saved. But what really made him a hero with France was the fact the winemakers discovered that their wonderful fermentation process was producing vinegar. It was damn good vinegar, but it wasn't wine. And he found out that by sterilizing the containers and using the right microorganism, you could produce, guess what, wine. And if you want to be a hero in France, that's the way to do it. And there's a memorial in every street in southern France has a fountain or an avenue or a boulevard named after Pasteur. Pasteur never was one very much to give credit to others. He did acknowledge the work of Edward Jenner, you know, who remember conquered cowpox and smallpox in England, and Lister, Lord Lister, the surgeon, who sprayed carbolic acid in his operating rooms to the tremendous irritation of the throats of everybody involved. But the wounds he was working on did not become subject to infection. Now, the interesting thing about those guys and others was that they knew what they were doing, but they didn't know why. They really didn't know why the infection, why these things happened to wine and other things. By, in effect, creating the science of bacteriology, Pasteur explained why these things happened. And the rest, as they say, is history. In 1935, my mother and dad took my middle brother, Ben, who was 4 years older than I was 15, we went to France and to Paris for the usual. We waited an hour and a half to get into Napoleon's tomb. The line was so far. Here was a tyrant whose work had killed hundreds of thousands of troops. When we got in a taxi, we asked to go to the Pasteur Institute on the Rue Docteur on the left bank. A little trouble finding it. Got there, shook the gate, rang the bell. A little old man came out, finally let us in. Some schoolboy French, which was fair then, much better now. He showed us through the labs. Pasteur died in 95. Everything is exactly as he left. His spectacles are on the desk. It's spooky. Every test tube is sealed off, and in it is the culture that was there when he died. It's fascinating. If he had walked back, there it would be. It was fascinating. And we then, having been shown around, we got in the taxi, and Dad said he needed some coins, and he said, Jamie, thank the man and give him this. So I did. Brother Ben and Dad got in a taxi, and I thanked the little man and asked him what his name was, and he told me. I got in the taxi, and as we drove off, Dad said, what did he say his name was? I said, he said his name was Joseph Meister. There was a dead silence. And Dad said to me, that was the baby boy who at age 14 had been brought to Pasteur, doomed to die of rabies. Pasteur, who was not a physician, had tested his vaccine on animals but never on humans, was not allowed to do so. If the boy died, he undoubtedly would have been imprisoned, maybe guillotined. And that was the boy who never left. He stayed as a helper, janitor, cleaner-upper. In 1939, France capitulated, and the Germans occupied France, and two German officers went to the Pasteur Institute because they were interested. They spoke some French. They rang and banged the door. This same little old man came down with a cane and looked at the officers. They demanded entrance. He denied them. One officer pulled a gun, pistol. The old man shook his head and in a wink pulled his own pistol out from under his smock, shot himself in the head, and lay dead across the gate. He's buried in the garden. The Alchemist is a subject of the talk, and you wondered when in the world I would ever get around to it. It's lots of fun, and you'll see a lot of alchemical pictures in the collection, and a few we're going to show you on the screen, only to sort of help you know what to look for. He was kind of the village idiot. He was a strange, oddball guy. You must remember that paintings painted religious paintings for 500 years, and they adorn all the churches and cathedrals of Europe, and they're magnificent. And royalty, you've had the king and the queen and the prince were all painted. But scenes of the ordinary village people, so-called genre paintings, are sort of new, and they came in perhaps around 1450, 1500. So here was a village scene with a very interesting oddball character who worked in the cellar and did strange things and made odd smells, and you could peek at him through a window and see what he was going on, although you really didn't know what he was doing down there. So he was the topic of a lot of very interesting drawings and etchings and paintings, and a number of Flemish, some German, a few Northern Italian, and almost no French, no British people painted him. And a lot of our work are Flemish, the present Netherlands and Belgium, of course. What in the world does it mean? Alchem comes from the Arabic word. It means dark soil for some reason, and the word alchem came out of that. And chemistry came out of that word. There are little tiny symbols of ancient China and Egypt dabbling in that sort of thing. What were these odd ducks trying to do? One, they were trying to turn base metal into gold. So they were backed privately or not so privately by royalty, because royalty meant you could buy troops, because troops were almost totally mercenaries. When George Washington crossed the Delaware, he attacked the Hessians, not the British. So that for centuries, troops were mercenaries. Money meant troops. So the rich boys, the royalty, backed the alchemist and said, in effect, you find the secret, Buster, remember it's mine. You sign the patents to me, if you want to use modern terms. The second thing they were trying to do, and by the way, at some 20 years ago, at some place in a cyclotron, some physicist was able to bombard the nuclei of gold and turn it back into lead. The second thing they're trying to do is find the elixir of life, the pill of immortality. Who isn't looking for that until you get to be kind of arthritic? But anyway, that was the other thing they were looking for. And these guys might find it. So you find them all mixed together, working a lot with metals to try and transmute them into gold, and also doing all kinds of bizarre experiments because, gosh, it was thought that the secret to the elixir of life and the pill of immortality was somewhere in a book. But remember, before we make fun of alchemists, we must remember that out of the alchemists, 1550 to late 1600s, came chemistry, medicine, certain branches of dentistry, botany, zoology, metallurgy, and to some degree physics. They derive from the old crazy lab worker, the alchemist. By the time you got into around 1700, modern science of Dalton, Lavoisier, Priestley, Boyle, and there's a wonderful picture of Boyle in this building, had sort of modernized science. So it wasn't the cut and dry. Edison was cut and dry. The alchemist invented cut and dry. And So while we make fun of him, he is the sort of great-great-great-great-grand-granddaddy of all kinds of laboratory science. And now, Tim, if you will, let's hit the light here, and I'll turn on this projector. We'll whip through a few slides. That's Louis Pasteur. Dad worshipped him and built the Pasteur Memorial and collection about him. He's an extraordinary man. He was not so terribly modest, but he did acknowledge the men I did mention. But unlike Newton said when he was honored late in his life, Newton, probably the greatest scientist in 500 years, they say that I stand tall among men, but if it is so, it is because I stand on the shoulders of giants. That is Pasteur's laboratory in a caricature cartoon. This is some of his glassware, and a lot of it is around this building, collected by Dad. And that is Joseph Meister, the little old man that let us in 1935 and denied the Germans in 1940. There's the old boy, and you see him working at the lab. It's typical of many, many of the old-timers. The book, the alembic, all kinds of botanicals in the background, a distillation going on there behind him, because that was seen in many of these pictures, a distillation going on here in the front. What you and I call a mortar and pestle in the very, very front there, which is seen in pharmaceutical laboratories. It used to be seen in old-time pharmacies, but and the heavy velvet gown, because heck, no heat in those days. Now, an interesting story here. There's the alchemist doing a very commonly performed test, the urine test for pregnancy. And the serving woman is pulled up her skirt there. You can see that not only is she a serving woman and a cleaning woman, but she also is pregnant. And mom is dumping the chamber pot because the results are pretty clearly positive, as one can see by the... And Dad here is getting the chamber pot for his indiscretions. But you see the mixture of science. You see a skull, the guy was messing around with physiology, the globe, geology, and the music, the bass, the cello, and an anatomical drawing behind him. All kinds of science mixed together. The old boy there with a tear in the chair because this didn't pay very well, this profession. The fume hood, as we would call it today, the distillation apparatus up under the hood. It's called a search. And here he is looking at the books. Golly, maybe the answer is in the next book. If I stay at it, I might hit it. You never can tell. Again, a very popular test. And, of course, the alchemist had one eye on the flask and one eye on the abdomen of his client. You see a dentist in the background pulling a tooth because they were all mixed together. And the barber surgeon, which later, of course, evolved into the surgeon, was often seen in these old scenes. There's a distillation apparatus here at the right going on. She seems to have her hand up saying, oh, my gosh, oh, boy. Here's the old guy working. And it's more or less the same as distillation apparatus. He's an old-timer. He's pretty ragged, pretty tired. Here is an old crone. I mean, maybe she's a serving woman that came as a delivery, because it seems unlikely that she's the one that whose urine he's testing for pregnancy, because it just wouldn't seem to fit. But you look at the mess, and he's involved in everything. On the ceiling, you find in many of these pictures both a fish, preserved fish, the ancient Christian symbol, and a lizard reptile, or one of those groups, because that is sort of the opposite of the Christian business. You played both sides, because if the powers that be were going to help you, it was sort of like betting on both horses in a two-horse race, because you don't know which power is going to empower you to solve the problem. So here you see both the fish at the ceiling, and these show up a lot better when you see the actual pictures, which I hope you will. And he is diagnosing her as obviously some sort of pregnancy. The old guy holding up the flask again, looking in the book, in the cellar. They're often below ground, and the usual fume hood They take away the fumes, which of course was convection. The heating source was not the famous Fisher burner, of course, but charcoal. This guy is dropping a scorpion into the mix. Why not? It might do the trick. And what have you got to lose? And there's a skull down here in the foreground. He's in a fume hood. Here's the old boy by the window. Now, this is a rather advanced sort of guy, but look at the mess. And there's a colloquium going on. They're still holding colloquiums all over the place. The scientists all over the place get together and talk each other to death. And that's what's going on here in the 1650s. Studying a book, maybe he has it. Maybe he can find the formula. This guy didn't calculate very correctly, and the safety of Marshall hadn't been around. He's working at home. How do we know? There's mom changing the baby in the background. The curtain has been pulled by the painter, so indeed you find it. Now, this painter, Hirschop, is a very famous Flemish painting. Some of these works are museum quality, absolutely beautiful museum quality. Some are just ordinary anonymous paintings. This guy's Hirschop, and he signed it in the book. When you see that painting, you will see that he signed it, a good Flemish name. Bang! There's a pewter tray in the front with a piece out of it. Who knows? Did he saw a piece out of that? Pewter, of course, is tin and lead mixed. Maybe that would be the base metal, which he could change to gold. Who knows? He miscalculated on that. This guy working by the window. Beautiful painting of the brass container there on the floor. A colloquium going on. No, I guess not. That's their assistants, laboratory assistants. They're probably graduate students. You get them for almost nothing. The skull, constant reminder of the time is limited. The beautiful tapestry, Turkish rug. Why not? In the old days, physicians and dentists hung their diplomas in the waiting room to impress you. Here, the tapestry, the Turkish rug on the table. So when you came in as a client, you were impressed. Because he had your clothes may be torn, the place is a mess, but you're impressed by the Turkish rug. This guy is mostly involved in anatomy. You see the magnificent painting of the human muscular structure. A dwarf in the foreground, puffing up the charcoal for the distillation that's going on. Assistants in the background with a fume hood. The light on the man's face is wonderful. It's a beautiful painting von Helmont. Again, a Flemish painter of about 1650-70. I'm not giving you a lot of painters' names because I'm just not going to remember them, but they are labeled, of course, in the Fisher Gallery. A rather dignified, older-timer guy with a red cap, beautiful. Notice the sword. Remember Damocles and the famous sword hanging by the thread. Don't get too uppity. The thread might break. So maybe as a reminder, this says, okay, old boy, you don't know everything. Remember the sword, and it could fall. The explosion again, this is rather big in those days, because he's working in secret to see you. The curtain is pulled because, this was secret stuff going on. And you didn't want to disclose too much. A wonderful painting of brass. This guy's preparing medicines of one kind or another. And you see natural herbs in the very foreground is endive, if you wish, from which it was supposed to have medicinal properties. And you took and made an elixir with alcohol, and you made medicine. So what this guy is really doing in the old days is making, this is a little pharmaceutical company. This is Lilly and Dow and the Merck and Sharp and Dohme and the whole schmear right here. Aha, guess what? The same old analysis with the same, and a concerned client, patient, whatever. Notice the fine Turkish rug on the table. That's impressive. It ups your fee. The old boy, isn't he wonderful? 10 years, great painter of alchemical pictures, working in the fume hood. The skull, he's below ground. You see the window, and his buddies in the background. 10 years painted the alchemist, but he also had a sense of humor. So here he portrays the alchemist. In French, it says le plaisir des fous, the pleasure of those who are nuts, who are foolish. And he makes fun of the alchemist working away at his lab in the fume hood, but has the sense of humor of saying they really were kind of, in a way, the object of ridicule. The discovery of phosphorus, because the old boys stumbled across probably 8 or 10 elements in the search for other things. It's called serendipity. You start to look for A and you find B. And here's the discovery of phosphorus from an engraving by Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, a wonderful painting. This is a wonderful engraving that Dad picked up from an agent in Europe. The old alchemical symbols. And there's a symbol for vitriolic acid, which is sulfuric acid, and a symbol for arsenic, and a symbol for sodium chloride, and on and on and on, long before Dalton proposed the present system. The old boy, now we come to modern times, much more modern. It's just at the end of the alchemical picture. And you see, here he's working with a wooden clamp, a test tube. It's not a Fisher Scientific clamp, but it's wood, and it won't rust like Fisher Scientific clamps. Won't rust either, but anyway, his chair is torn and battered, but he has a certain elegance of velvet and maybe a little fur around the collar, a mess on the floor, but he's working with something quite modern. And is that it? Thank you. May I have the lights, Tim? Now, I simply want to say, and as a wind-up, excuse me, that I will take questions. Let me see. I think our time is just right. Do we have a few minutes for questions before we break up? I have lots of answers. I will be at the reception. You can quiz me. I want to just say in conclusion that this collection here in this institution is a real jewel. It's unique in Philadelphia. It's unique in the state. It's unique in the country. It's unique in the world. And I hope very much that you people here in Philadelphians will take very good care of it. You've been a wonderful audience. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
How many pieces are in the collection? Are they all here?
The whole collection is here. It can't possibly be exhibited. There are probably 200 frameable, hangable works of art, paintings, engravings, lithographs, photographs, everything. And then there are objects, laboratory objects of all kinds. There's an old balance, there are old microscopes, there are old glassware, ancient bottles, all kinds of stuff. They'll need a lot more room to exhibit all of it, and it will be rotated. You can see a very nice cross sampling in two places, in the Chester Fisher Memorial Gallery, and also in a small room at the end of the boardroom in this building that shows 6 or 8 pictures just acquired from a collector in California whose name?
Roy Edelman.
Apparently attracted by the Fisher collection, as my dad used to say, them as has, yits. And like the Metropolitan, you have a great collection, everybody wants to give stuff to the Metropolitan, they don't know what to do with it, but it's prestige. So anyway, one attracts the other. And there are some wonderful alchemical pictures that have just recently been arrived. They're in a small windowless room at the back of the boardroom. Yes, sir?
I'm sure know that Newton did spend more time on alchemy than he did on
Newton did indeed spend time on alchemy, and so did Boyle, who is credited with a great deal of modern chemistry, and if you remember your chem classes, and I'm sure you don't, Boyle's law of partial pressure and Boyle's law of gases, I remember it very well. But anyway, he dabbled in alchemy. I guess, why not? Maybe you'll hit something big. Maybe you'll hit penicillin. Fleming did. He took a vacation. The stuff was in the sink, and he came in Monday. Bingo! Penicillin was discovered. Totally by accident. Yes, sir? Thousands of prints. Dad was smart as all get out. He offered engravings, reproductions, good quality, with very modest company name on them, very modest, both black and whites and colors. Probably both sales and giveaway, the salesmen were given a quota they could place them, 25,000, and they still do at a very modest price, both framed and unframed, of the outstanding parts of the collection. What a stroke of genius. You hung this on the director of the laboratory's wall. He had pride in the alchemist, his heritage, his great-great-great-great-great predecessor. And when he moved, retired, or whatever, The new man moved into the head of the laboratory's office. Guess what? There was the picture. Nobody ever took it down. He drove our competition bananas. There's a question over here, sir. Yeah.
I want to say about Newton, he applied what he learned in alchemy when he became director of the Royal Mint. He had to know how to analyze the gold to make sure it was proper purity.
He was smart in many ways. He stood on the shoulders of giants. I think that's the most extraordinary quotation that I know of. Any more? I beg your pardon? Father died in 84. He went from his desk to the hospital. Both my brothers are deceased. I'm the youngest and survivor. They were born in 8, 16, 8, 12, 16, and 20. One died as an infant. I was born in 20. So I am the last of.
Wednesday morning at 8:35. Good morning. Stop. Now, I'm closer to the mic here, so let me get a better break. The mic is right here. This is Wednesday the 19th, and this is a test with our guest. Let's see how it goes. Okay, we're now recording.
Excellent.
Recording. We have Marge and Lloyd and Jim here on the 19th of May in Pittsburgh, and you had some questions, like 150.
Yeah, 19th of December in 2001.
Right.
And we're here to hear Jim.
Good and loud.
We're here to talk to Jim Fisher's memories about his memories of the Fisher Collection of Chemical Art and his memories of his father and of the artwork. So, Jim, I wanted to start out talking to you about your childhood, who your family members were, their names, your parents' names, the names of your siblings, any extended family members that you think should be mentioned and that were involved and loved the artworks that we now have in our collection.
Well, the Fisher Collection, some of which is art and some of which is copies and some photographs and drawings and could or couldn't be described as art. Matt and Dad always referred to it as the Fisher Collection. The company was always referred to as the Fisher Collection of Alchemical and Historical Pictures. And Dad was not nearly so much interested as to whether it was art, so long as it had a scientific connection. That's why he started it. Now, to go back to your question, mother was Margaret R. Aiken, A-I-K-E-N, which is my middle name, and also the first name of my oldest brother. Both of our brothers are deceased now. And her family was Scott-Irish, from what is now called Northside Pittsburgh, an area originally called Allegheny City, and originally the second or third largest city in Pennsylvania, now a part of the city of Pittsburgh. Father came from a German family, and his grandfather spelled his name with a C, which is the only way you can spell Fisher in German. There is no SH in German. It's SCH. So when grandfather came to this country in about 1840, he took the C out because he thought making it F-I-S-H-E-R was more, quote, American. He changed Johann to John, so he became John Fisher. And he had a C left over because he took it out. So he put it in his middle initial. And it made him John C. Fisher, and he was just the man who saved everything, and he didn't want to have a C lying around left over, so he made a middle initial out. That was a very common heritage, a Scottish and German. Believe it or not, that was in this area was a very common marriage get together. The Scottish troops came into Pittsburgh with John Forbes in 1758, the Scottish troops under John Forbes, who was Scottish, came in and captured Fort Duquesne from the French and Indians. Duquesne was the French governor of Canada, then called New France. And they saw a large group of troops coming in and knew that they were going to be defeated, so they abandoned the fort, set fire to it, and left. So it was kind of a hollow victory, but didn't make any difference. The British got it anyway. When those Scottish troops, quote, captured the fort, if you want to give them credit. In baseball, they say you get credit for the win. A lot of the Scottish troops stayed in this area. So you had original Scottish settlement, small, here. And they sent for wives and sisters. And then when the Germans came in sometime later, 40, 50 years later, a huge German invasion. So you had that part of the city thickly populated by Scottish and German people. We had 11 breweries over in that part of the city, of Allegheny City, now called North Side. And there were German singing groups and bands and German clubs and the Rathskellers, and it was very, very German. then Dad came from that heritage, and they met as young people. Dad saw Mother sitting in a box at a theater, a just startlingly handsome woman with thick black wavy hair, very handsome young woman. I think she was perhaps 20 at the time. And he decided he would meet her at intermission, and so he went up to her and introduced himself. And they courted and were married in 1905. And the first son, my brother Aiken, was born in 08. So that's how the family got started. I'm chasing down both sides of the family through a genealogist and the urgings of my children.
Wonderful.
And so I'm doing a tree and all that sort of stuff. And the oldest brother was Aiken. He was born in 08. My father was a very methodical man. And this is all in the tape you heard, Lloyd, except they didn't let you hear it, which is too bad. Anyway, Dad was a very methodical man. He graduated in college. He was born in 80, which is nice and neat. He graduated from the University of Pittsburgh, then called Western University of Pennsylvania, in 00, keeping it nice and neat. And his four sons, there were no daughters, the four sons were born exactly 4 years apart in 8, 12, 16, and 20. And they were all boys that were exactly 4 years apart within a month.
Wow.
Now, the family members were involved with the collection only through business. Because the Fisher collection really stayed in the business. It didn't come home. We never had anything from the Fisher collection hanging in the house where I was born, where all of us were born. Naturally, we knew about it because one son died in infancy, but the three, which I'm remaining, all worked in the business. Right after graduation from college, the oldest brother, Aiken, graduated in 29 and went to work for the company. We'd all worked there in summers before. And another brother graduated from college in 38 and went right to work there. I graduated in LA. Actually, Pearl Harbor came along, and I graduated early. I was class of 42, but got out in late 41 or very early 42. Because, of course, Pearl Harbor had been attacked, and worked for Alcoa, the Aluminum Company of America, working in a, what you might today call a smelter plant, a plant that turns ore into aluminum, which is badly needed, of course, for war plants. And following the war, end of 44, early 45, I left Alcoa and went to work for the company. So eventually we all worked for the company. And when you worked for the company, you had to be aware of the Fisher collection because it was hung all over the offices.
Right.
And it was rather indiscriminate because wherever you had a wall, Dad had something hung there. And the people who worked in the company was pretty small in those early days, took quite an interest in it because, you know, hanging right over their desk or right next to their desk was a couple of old alchemists blowing up some ancient laboratory. They couldn't help but notice it. But the collection and the company were inseparable. And of course, Dad was the inspiration for it. I've been trying to think when I got you early. Dad began collecting, I believe, right after World War I, which of course ended in 1918. And before that war started in 1914, and the source was Europe. There was no other source, really. So I don't think there was any collection before 1914. The company was only 12 years old.
Right.
And Dad had his hands full with 3, 4, 5, 6 employees. It started with 2, as you know. And I don't think he did any... I don't think he'd been to Europe. I don't believe he'd made a European trip. which wasn't essential, but it was useful in tracking down the dealer who had such a narrow interest.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Most of these pictures were bought through a dealer who had a very specific and focused interest in a few things.
You have no memory or knowledge of who that dealer was?
Oh, it's in the records. Some of the records I've tried to chase down. And Harry Sweldon, you can call later if he's in town. I have his on this number here.
Oh, that'd be great.
And I don't think he has a recollection of who the dealers were. But the towns were London, Paris, Brussels, the heart of the Flemish painting, of course, and a lot of these rather fine works that really are artworks as well as historical were Flemish.
Yes.
As Netherlands and
yes.
Belgium. And let me see, maybe a dealer in Germany somewhere. I don't recollect which city. But those were the prime sources, these three or four dealers. And those dealers, as you know, are amazing. They can kind of smell something. And they trade information from dealer to dealer. Because one has a customer who has a certain interest, and he trades it with another dealer who has a different interest. And that way they move stuff.
That's right. They support each other.
That's right. They do. And that's so. My best guess is Dad took an interest in about 1920 would be my first guess. And what tricked it off and what triggered it, I don't know. It might be that he made a trip to Europe in the 20s. I know he did. But it might have been the early 20s, because his mother went fairly often to Europe, on steamship, of course, and always Cunard Line. That was reliable because you could trust the English. Also, there was no language problem. There was a language problem on a ship anyway, because they always have a multilingual crew. But mother was zero linguist. Dad spoke a little German because his grandfather and mother were German, you see, and they would sing some German songs when I was a kid at Christmas time. Old Tannenbaum, old Christmas tree. And they had a few little tiny jokes in German. My grandmother, who lived to be almost 90, obviously was pretty good in German. So they went to Europe, and I think that's how Dad first may have got the idea. I don't know what sparked the original thought, but he began to take an interest and ask about dealers. And of course, dealers were happy to.
Sure.
All Americans were considered rich, and you're American. I mean, that was big stuff. And they would make a record of what he was interested in and send him photographs. And
so they sent him photographs
very often.
I see.
And then as he became better established and known to them, he always paid his bills very promptly.
Yes.
And incidentally, he made this collection himself, and he paid for it himself. Much later, the company bought it to get it out of his estate.
Oh.
He must have been in his late 70s.
Oh, really?
The early 80s. He died when he was 84. But oldest brother, Aiken, a very, very wise man, extraordinarily wise man, he was a think-ahead guy. And he knew that some federal appraiser could put a value that was complete nonsense, because he didn't understand it. So he just put
right.
X million bucks or whatever.
Right.
So he had the company buy the collection. And that, of course, took it at a reasonable price, a very modest price. And then that all just became buried. That was all history. And the company owned it. So it wasn't in Dad's estate. And when the company was sold, and I was out of the company, had I been there, I think I would have thought of it. When the company was sold, they made the mistake of selling the collection with
right.
And that was a mistake
right.
because then it bounced all around the place.
Right.
And
thank
it was
goodness
a terrible
you tracked that down.
Good morning.
Just dump it over there, please.
Sure,
thank you very much. Excuse me, there's a mailman coming. I locked the door. That's my guess as to how he got started.
So your dad must have had incredible files and records if he received photographs and from these dealers.
He did.
Did he save some, do you think?
Well, You see, when the company was sold, I wasn't in the company.
Yeah.
And Ben and Aiken had relatively little interest in the collection. I was the one that took over for the interest. I bought the number of works.
Yes.
After Dad died in 65. Yes, he died in 1965. So I became the one who became interested in it. And when the company was sold, I wasn't in the company. I had been let go on a separation agreement with, we had an altercation with the then president. And so I had no idea what happened to those records. You see, another company came in and just took over the whole, and they had absolutely no appreciation of what they had. They didn't even know what they had.
So where's Harry Schwab fit into this, well, and John Pavlik?
Well, Harry Schwab was the original self-appointed curator. And he got to be that because we used our collection of alchemical and historical pictures as part of our advertising and public relations program. And he was a writer that I had hired for the advertising department.
Oh.
I was vice president of marketing. And that meant sales promotion, direct mail, catalogs, publications, sales training. We did our own printing. We owned our own ad agency. I don't know, a lot of things.
Right.
And Harry was a writer in the advertising department, which acted like an advertising agency, but really a department of the company. And Harry was a walk-in, and I hired him, and he showed me what he could do in 10 minutes, and I hired him. And he wrote a publication, he wrote a lot of publications for us, and the publication he first worked on was one that Dad had started. And we used an alchemical picture of some sort, or one from the collection, on the front cover.
Mm.
The way Life magazine always had a full bleed front cover picture. Look did the same thing for a while. And so it was kind of the trademark or style of the publication, which was called The Laboratory.
What and date would that have been that the first picture was used? Do you have a recollection?
Well, it would be very early in the issue of the first Laboratory. Schwab would know the dates of that the company, and John Pavlik would know the dates because they had a complete collection of every issue of the Laboratory.
Is there any chance that there's an extra collection that we could add to our archives, an extra set? Of these.
Oh, we're lucky to get one set of the Laboratory. You know, Marge, it's very funny. When history is happening, so very, very, very few people realize it's happening.
Sure. That's normal.
And I, you know, I expected to work till I was 75 or something at the company.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I might survive the brothers, which I have. And I didn't know whether it was family owned, and they let me have a little cubicle in the corner or something so I could, you know, collect my mail and come in a couple of days a week like Dad did. Mm-hmm. He tapered off. Mm-hmm. And I would have kept an interest in history, but you see, all of a sudden I wasn't there.
Yes.
I left the company in 1979. Oh. And so, and all of this mess happened later. Excuse me. So there was no duplicate. In the 50s, one could have set up a duplicate copy of The Laboratory because you could dig around and find every one that had been published for, 35 years, I think. John can answer that and call him if he's in town, and of course Harry would answer that.
Of course, Xeroxes would be perfectly acceptable for us, and we can look into that later.
Well, there is a complete...
As a research record.
There is a complete set. Of the Laboratory.
Yeah.
35, 40 years, and then it stopped, just stopped. And as you know, it stopped, and people thought they were paying for it as a periodical and kept writing and saying, my subscription has run out.
Well, you see how much, how good a job this advertising did. I can't believe how many people remember.
It was
these
a.
There's
a company history here on the table. I gave it, it was written for a business, it was written by Fisher Scientific, public relations And it was written for as a hope to get it into, well, the Wall Street Journal, because we're 100 years old in May, as you know. And sometimes the journal will go for one of those family companies survives 100 years and still doing what it was doing when it set out, which is very unusual because, you know, you started out to make buggy whips, and now you're making computers. It's the same company. But here's a company that set out to do laboratory equipment supply, and today is the largest in the world doing laboratory equipment supplies. And so that may have a little what's called a news hook that would appeal to the journal. So Norm Ritter at Fisher is doing that, and I'll find it for him. And he wrote and I rewrote and he wrote and I rewrote a mini history of the company.
Great.
For the publication. Also, I have here for you the Fisher News, which is an internal newspaper for employees. When it was 70 years of age.
Great.
So that is,
thank you.
Useful to you.
Yes.
So we're just guessing as to when the first alchemical pictures were started to become, but probably in the 20s, probably as a result of traveling to Europe. But something crossed Dad's mind that he could dignify and therefore cultivate the scientists by this collection. And the collection was kind of homage to science, who was largely unrecognized. He was a man behind the guns. Way down in the dumps was a lab somewhere. And the steel manufacturers, they got all the pizzazz up front. It was glamorous, and these huge rolls of steel came in. But of course, every roll had to be tested, and way back somewhere,
there was
down the hospital corridor in the cellar, was a lab,
et cetera.
So his customers, therefore, were the unglamorous, the unrecognized, the unappreciated people. And until the atom bomb and the attack on Japan, you remember President Truman came out with a speech, "We have won the battle of the laboratories as we have won the other battles," announcing the victory over Japan. That was the headline in every newspaper, and I don't know whether television was in effect at that time, maybe not, but that was the headline.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden people said, listen, the battle of the laboratories, and the word laboratory suddenly began to take on significance.
Yeah. Yes.
The whole Manhattan Project,
right,
and atomic energy,
charisma,
all came out of the lab. And so suddenly it wasn't confused with laboratory, which it was for years. And in the story I can't find,
we had that
visitors to the house, and this was in my speech.
Yes.
You didn't hear it. But when you get to Philadelphia, you can hear the speech. And Mother's house was kind of a curiosity because if you could be invited, you could ask to use the bathroom, because it was just an ordinary bathroom, even though he was in laboratory supplies. So that's how it started, and it started very small. And after a certain number of issues, which is recorded in the laboratory, he began to put the parts of the collection on the front cover. Up to that point, the front cover was all print.
I see.
It had maybe four lines of like little headlines. And, he wrote that for years before I took over. And they were interesting headlines. You know, he put a little spark in them. They weren't just dull.
Sure.
But it wasn't nearly as interesting as having some old poop, in the middle of the 17th century blowing up a big cauldron of something,
right,
on the front cover. I mean, that was intriguing.
Oh, right.
So he began to put those on the front cover. And
what about the posters? When did they start?
They came in a good bit later, the reproductions. He waited quite a while. I believe we started the reproductions in both color and black and white probably around 1950.
Mm-hmm.
I believe so, because when I went with the company after the war, let's call it 45, I don't recollect that we offered the reproductions then. Now, a search of the catalogs, of which I had many, could document that because we began to list those reproductions in our regular catalog, which is, as you know, hundreds and even thousands of pages. And we did some smart things. I don't know who did this. Maybe I did. We assigned numbers to the 7 or 8 black and white reproductions as B1, B2, and the colored one says A1, A2, A3. Now, what that was done was to avoid complication, but it was also done so that the laboratory or stockroom man could, on a requisition list, put down the 2-540 beakers, one case of 10-040 flasks, 2 A1.
They
got two colored prints. You see, it went right through the purchasing
department.
The print department didn't know what it was. They took the requisition,
yeah,
and it was all approved to set the order through. So when this box arrived at the lab, it had all the thermometers and chemicals and loads of, and a couple of pictures were in there, too. And they were offered
great.
Framed and unframed.
That's great.
And I've forgotten what the designation was for framed or unframed.
Yeah,
But they all had a number, and that helped us. Of course, the stock boys, they much prefer to work by numbers. You know, do you want a 2-540-400? I said,
right, they don't care.
Griffin Beaker, 400 Melodies.
Mm-hmm.
And same with that test. A1 framed was A1 framed. They're all pre-cartoned and put it in the box with all the rest of the stuff.
Right.
So that's when it began to become very popular. We also put salesmen on a quota. Everybody had they go wild if you let them go, you know, they'd say, send me 200.
Yeah.
So, and they cost quite a bit. Framed, especially framed. So a salesman was given a quota, I don't know what it was, a few, a dozen or so a year, whatever. And he would pick selected customers. And then one fine day, he would go into the chief chemist and they would do their business and so forth. And then he'd say, Dr. Jones, I have something here for you I think you will enjoy. And he'd hand him B1 or A1 or whatever. Oh, I was very flattered to have it.
Sure.
And the other smart thing was, when it started out, it was a little bit advertising-like. It had a good bit more print about the company on it than I felt smart. I wanted to play this down because I wanted it to get on walls and people kind of, if you put too much advertising on there, they're going to kind of react.
Right.
So I had in very light type on there, and it's there today, I believe.
Quite discreet.
Something from, reprinted with permission from the Fisher Collection. That's all it says.
I think it's quite discreet.
And it's very light. Mm-hmm. And it says Fisher Collection. It doesn't even say Fisher Scientific Company.
I know.
And that's enough.
I thought that
Now, the nice thing about that is, and this is in the tape they didn't let you hear, is that when the chief chemist was promoted or retired or died or moved or whatever, the new chief chemist, which was probably his assistant, moved into the lab, into the same lab office, and there was the picture on the wall. Well, why was he going to move it? He was glorifying it.
Right.
So it drove our competitors nuts because there was the darn thing hanging on the wall, no matter who was the chief guest. It just kept changing. But it was a brilliant idea of Dad's and just turned into a kind of a icon associated with the company. It became very closely associated with the company.
Absolutely.
It wasn't unique. There was a chemical company in Detroit that had run by a guy named Bayer.
Right.
And he had some alchemical pictures, some really quite good original oil paintings.
Yes.
Half a dozen, I think.
Many of his were religious, though. They were just, there were not many that were chemical.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that. He was in the chemical business. And
right,
you think, but you see, when he went around to try and buy them, there weren't a whole lot left because Dad had been at this for years. And he used them on his little publication, his little advertising publication.
Right. I think it is.
And he became associated with his company.
Aldrich Company.
Yeah, Aldrich
Aldrich
Company.
Right.
He would often write a story about it because he was very, Alfred is very interested in art history. He's kind of an art dealer now.
Oh, really? He became an art dealer?
Yes, in 17th century Dutch art. He was also was forced out of his company and has taken this up as a second career. And he's become the world's greatest dealers of Rembrandt.
Oh, no kidding. You've got to be good at that game, boy.
And he's famous for his eye.
I see.
And very admired for his eye.
Amazing, hasn't it? Brings all of it. But you will come on this recorder, and I'm telling you to write it now. So that you come on.
That's right. It's awesome. It's probably awesome.
I don't know. It's not be part of it.
I don't know why, except for four rings. but my fax machine doesn't work either this morning. But you know, I have to take it inside. Fisher. Go ahead, Linda. Yeah, right. It's okay. That's fine.
Right, Bill.
Thank you. Sorry. This is an answer, and I don't know why. Yeah.
That's fine, no problem.
Well, we're very interested in seeing if Alfred, I'm sure Alfred must have been inspired by
Chen.
Well, sure he was. Sure he was. I'll come across that thing I'm doing for somebody else.
I had
that save you, and I'll find it. Well, let's see. That's how we got into it, and that's how he started to use it for public relations, advertising, whichever you prefer. And which brings me to a closely related subject. I don't think I did this in the talk because the time was too limited. The alchemists also used the signs of the zodiac because there could be more propitious days than others. If you did certain experiment on certain time of the year and related to the zodiac, you know, under Pisces or whatever, you might have a better luck of doing what you were trying to do, which of course was transmute metals. And so the signs of the zodiac appear on the floor, set in stone or in other forms in old laboratories. And in Germany, I believe it's in the Munich Museum, which is an absolutely marvelous museum. Fab, I could spend 2 weeks there. There is a reproduced alchemical laboratory, quite authentic. I say authentic as if I knew, because nobody was there. But and it has the circle with the 12 circles around it, like a clock, in the floor, as I remember. It's a long time since I've been there. Well, that appeared in some pictures. And Dad decided, when Dad made up his mind about some of these things, that was it. There was no changing it. I mean, he decided, you know, pink is gray. It's gray. There's no question about it. All the world is wrong. It's gray. And he decided that that was this alchemist symbol for the laboratory. That was his own, because of course the alchemists used symbols. There was a symbol for silver and a symbol for gold and a symbol for sulfuric acid and the like. So nobody could persuade him that that was not true. So we adopted, the company adopted, the sign of the zodiac, the circle with 12 circles around it, and the letter F in the middle, Fisher, as the logo of the company. Today, they have dropped the outer circles and kept the center circle. And that's where it came from. That's what they dropped.
I didn't know that.
The guys with sense of humor in the company said they'd knocked the meatballs off around the outside. That's what they did. They knocked the 12 meatballs off around the circle and ended up with the inner circle with the F. The F is, I changed the F twice to keep in style, because lettering has style.
Yes, absolutely.
It goes in vogue and out.
Absolutely.
I changed it a couple times. I think what they're now using is pretty close to something I figured out way back. But that's where the circle came from, and that's where Dad got the idea. That comes back to the alchemy lab. Now, as I said,
I mean, if the paintings and engravings weren't actually in your home, how young were you when you started visiting your dad?
You'd go down to see Dad for some reason or other downtown. You'd meet Dad in his office because maybe Mother was coming in town to have dinner with Dad, or the whole family was going to have dinner at the Duquesne Club, which is a downtown club here. And so you'd stop in his office while Mother waited. I don't recollect it. I never, to my recollection, never saw her go in the office. I don't think in her entire life she ever was in Dad's office. Mm. You've got to remember, she was born in 1881, and she comes into the 1900s from a completely different century. Women stayed home, took care of the house, raised the children. Of course, there weren't any women in the office in 1900 either. The typing pools were all men.
No,
it was World War I that put women in the office, and that was 1917, 1918. After that, women were in the office. It became telephone operators and typists and clerks and all kinds of things. So Mother never came. I don't think in her life Mother ever came into the office. But I would come into the office and visit Dad, who was just, I'd be right with you, Jamie, as I was calling, cleaning up his desk, sit down. And I can remember looking around, and there were alchemical pictures there, but they were scattered all over the building. All kinds of alchemical pictures. And a lot of stuff in files, because he, as I said, Dad collected on the theme. Did it have any interest? Did it have any historical connection? Didn't matter if it was fine work or not.
Right. There's so many engravings, portraits, and
copies,
apparatus, and
photographs.
Many of them are fine old engravings. Yeah,
that's right.
Many.
And copies of engravings,
yes.
And photographs of engravings.
And the engravings are copies of the art of the painting.
Of a painting
before, right. Which is very important historically.
So it was. You can see filing cabinets, really filing cabinets full of stuff, which you couldn't see. But Dad had a whole bunch of filing cabinets.
Did he sometimes show them to you? Like,
well, he'd show
a
visitor would come, and maybe by appointment. We didn't get a lot of visitors in those days until we built the museum, and that was my baby. I said, we can make a whole lot more out of this collection in terms of, I was then became vice president of marketing, and I was thinking of all kinds of ways.
Sure.
And I said, we were doing some reconstruction in addition to the building. In 1946, we built an addition to the building. And I went to Aiken and I said, let's do this. We're going to have to build a new cafeteria. We have way outgrown the other one. And while we're talking about plans for this new building, which is bigger than all the other buildings we've already built in downtown Pittsburgh, why don't we think about a little private dining room and a place for the collection? And he said, what do you mean the collection? I said, well, let's make it kind of a museum. Let's pick 20 or 30 items, of which we have dozens and dozens and dozens, and hang them in a style that is really very high class. Like, everybody thinks more of artwork if you go into a beautiful art museum that has marble than you would have if the same things were hanging in the barn. Same art.
Absolutely. But context is everything.
Context, exactly. And then we could invite people to come and visit our museum. And it'd be a real goodwill thing. We could also take them through our building and show them our computer system. We were just getting computers at that time.
Uh-huh.
If they have time, we'll run them up to a big factory just built in Indiana County, which is near Pittsburgh. Except, well, they decided he'd like to think big. And he thought, well, boy, you give him a big idea, he liked that. He would grab onto a big idea. So he said, go ahead. So we built this museum, and we built a little room attached to it. And attached to that was the kitchen, which served the cafeteria, but it was a complete modern kitchen. So you could get the bigwigs to come in, the purchasing guy or the chief chemist or some coming. The salesman would come in with him, because of course they had waiting time and airport time, and they became your buddy-buddy. I mean, you had people you were pretty chubby with. And they would be met by a car, we'd arrange, and they'd come in, and we would have a look at the museum, at the pictures, and we'd explain what they were, and that was very impressive. And broke all the rules about serving sherry. We didn't want to get into booze, and we didn't want to get into cocktails in the middle of the day, and you know, red or white wine and all this sort of stuff. So I hit upon the idea, why don't we have a couple of good bottles of sherry? They lasted a long time now. I bought some little wee glasses and a nice tray, silver-plated tray. These were classic.
Yeah.
They have that sitting in a table in the middle of the museum. These people would come in from Indianapolis and Dubuque and Detroit and Minneapolis and God knows where. And they were ushered in, and this, we had this other idea that whoever was in town of Aiken, Ben, and me, and sometimes it was all three, and sometimes it was just two, it depended. If you were in town, you got a notice way in advance as to who was coming in, and the company, and a little bit of the financial background, and how our sales were, and who the competitor was, a little digest of the situation, which you could read in about 3 minutes. So in comes the guy, and he would have the sherry, see the picture, step through the door, all walnut, have a very nice one-plate lunch served in the private dining room. And the dining room was a memorial to Louis Pasteur, the French chemist who was dead, was a great supporter of. I mean, he was an extraordinary man. Everybody knows about him. And so, and we would tell about him while we were sitting there at lunch. Right. And then we'd get the subject around to the company's, the customer's company, and he was just, his mind was blown, because here was the president of the company, two senior vice presidents of the company, who knew the facts and dates and that, how much business we bought, who the competitors were, all about his company. And then if he went to our Indiana plant, which is a huge factory, and then drove to the airport, he would get a, I mean, these guys never got up. It became a standard one-day package. And people became just, I mean, they never stopped talking about it. I mean, there was just nobody else in the business after that. They were just swamped.
Wonderful.
It was a very clever act. Now that was, you see, using the pictures in a very discreet, measured, high-class way.
Yes.
He wasn't thrown at him. It was.
Yes.
It was Fisher Collection. It just happened to be in our building.
Yes.
And the Pasteur room was a totally non-commercial. It was a memorial to this great French chemist.
Right.
And I mean, that's not commercial. That's.
It made them feel so good about their profession.
Yeah, especially if they're scientists.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a coup, and we carried that on for years and years and years. And the Allied company came and bought it. There was a, I'm sorry, it was out by then, but there was a very tough talking and tough man named Hennessy, who was the boss, the ruthless boss of Allied Corporation. And he bought this company thinking it was something it wasn't, because he told somebody else, using some very foul language I won't repeat.
You mean in buying Fisher?
He thought he had bought A, and he ended up buying B. Not that, I don't think that my brothers defrauded him. He said, I'll clean it up a little bit. He said, I believed all the propaganda and stuff that damn Jim Fisher wrote in his catalogs. Because he had the impression that we manufactured everything, because we had 5,000 Fisher brand items we didn't make. He's Fisher brand. So he was in a big hurry for everything.
Uh-huh.
Everybody was buying high-tech companies. He thought he was buying Alchemy.com company or something. So he, after he'd bought it, he made a visit to the company and was met by John Pavlik, who wore a white shirt and was all shined up, and they cleaned the building, and tours of the building was arranged, and he swept through the building like royalty. They took him down, headed to the private dining room. And on the way there, where he was to have a bite of lunch, followed by his accolades, ring bearers, and treated well, got to the door of the Fisher Collection, which he had bought. That was the mistake I mentioned. And opened the door. Hennessy gets to the door, and he says, "What's this?" And somebody says, "Well, Mr. Hennessy, this is some samples from the Fisher collection. This is the Fisher Museum." And he never stepped in the door. He said brutally to some friend, "How much is this stuff insured for?" And the accolade said, "I don't know, Mr. Hennessy, but I'll find out," making a note quickly from his notebook. "So I don't know, but I'll find out." And Hennessy turned around and walked away. So that was how much interest they had in it.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
They didn't know what they bought, nor did they care, nor did he care. And he's a strange man. And so John Pavlik, who was then the curator, is standing in the doorway as they walk away down the hall. There was anything like it. Never heard of anybody, did at least three steps, you know, and you put your head around it. Not 1993 steps.
Yeah.
So that was it. That was the end of it. And it got sold, as you know, the history of the company went through ups and downs and ended up in completely different hands, which is where it now is. And they have a very fine respect for it.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
And so they use it. Now, I think as a kid, somewhere along the line, maybe it was not when I was summer jobbing. My first summer job there, and this is all in the document I have here and in the talk, I wrapped packages in the receiving department. So stuff came in bulk. Might be 200 packages of filler paper. 100 pieces to a pack,
right.
So packages, and they'd be this big crate. Well, you don't sell them that way. You sell them in dozens.
Right.
So you'd take 12 and wrap them and put a label on it. And you put a label on it, which was Dad's idea, because then you didn't get them so mixed up in the stock department. Mm-hmm. And you picked orders by catalog number, like Sears Roebuck does, mm-hmm. or as Sears Roebuck does. So the time to get the right catalog on is that when you first receive it, because then it isn't going to get fixed up later on. So when it first comes in, get your catalog number on, because you live by catalog. And I spent several summers wrapping glassware and thermometers, and it came in bulk.
So was there art in the stock room as well?
No, that was... It was too,
too
might,
messy.
You might move a box into it and crush it.
So was it in the offices?
Offices. And some labs. We had a research lab, and it had some works in it.
Did it?
And the offices of the research people had reproductions or some originals. That was a bit of a... When we formed the museum, that was a bit of a heartbreak, because you'd go into some guy who had a picture on his wall for 10 or 15 years, and you were quite accustomed to it, and you'd say, "George, I'm sorry to tell you, but we're creating a museum, and we're going to put some of these pictures in the museum. They're kind of the highlights
attached.
Of the collection. And I'm afraid to tell you, we're going to take that away. And we can replace it if you like. We'll give you a choice. We'll work it out with you, because we got some other nice things that we're not going to put in the museum. We can put that back in your office."
Right.
So what is he going to say? He said, grudgingly, "Well, okay."
But he wasn't happy.
No, he wasn't happy, but he got another picture
right.
on his wall. I gave him a little class, you know.
Right. You do form attachments to certain paintings that you live with. You absolutely do.
So, it was the publication that had it on the cover, and the beginning to offer the reproductions in the catalog, the general catalog, that began to create the interest and the recognition of the collection.
Yeah.
And if you keep that up for 20 or 30 years, you get it closely associated with the company.
Oh, absolutely. The Fisher Collection is very closely associated in many people's minds. I tour so many people through the collection, and they have reproductions at home. They love them.
They've heard about it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Many, many, over and over again.
Yeah. Well, that's what I really know. Of course, they couldn't all be in Father's office. It was a modest office, and he had four pictures, I think, or something in his office.
About really?
Something like that, that's right.
Really?
None at home.
Did he have particular friends or colleagues that... he shared this interest with that you can recollect?
Well, he had one close personal friend who was also a business client, customer. And that was a man named Weidlein, W-E-I-D-L-E-I-N, Dr. Weidlein. He was a man from Kansas who took his Ph.D. very seriously. And he was spent his entire life known as Dr. Weidlein. He wanted you to know that. He had three boys, and we grew up with the boys. They were close friends. Two of them are still living today. And are good friends of mine. One of them is exactly my age.
Hmm.
And he and his wife and my mother and father were close bridge-playing friends. People played bridge in those days. Dr. Weidlein was about 7 or 8 years younger than Dad. But he was a very nice, pleasant man, always polite. And although self-important. And Dr. Weidlein was well aware of the collection because he and Dad were personal friends, and they would talk about The Alchemist and the history of science. And Dr. Weidlein was a Ph.D. in chemistry.
Oh.
And director of the Mellon Institute of Industrial Research.
Oh.
So obviously steeped in laboratory science and history science.
Wonderful.
And so they shared that
mm-hmm.
for years. But my dad's other friends were industrial people, but they were not laboratory people. They were industry people, executives.
Right.
In manufacturing, most part. And Dad had a rather large collection because he played golf. He took up golf when he was about 38 or 40. And his tennis became a little too tough on the knees, as it does for everybody. And went to the golf pro to take some early lessons. He was a natural athlete, and he played pretty good golf. I imagine he played pretty good tennis, too, before that. And he said to the pro, "Gee, I wish I'd started this golf earlier." And the pro said, "Mr. Fisher, it's already too late." But Dad perfected his own style, and he enjoyed it. And, oh, he loved to play golf. Hot weather or not, he loved to play golf.
Did you ever hear him discussing the apparatus that was depicted in the artworks?
Yes. When he acquired a new part of the collection, whatever it was, a drawing, a photograph, historical document, as I became more and more interested in it, I became the kind of designated driver. I became the one. Aiken and Ben, we were all very busy, but Aiken and Ben never took a great interest in it. Enough so they weren't diffident, and when we had these gatherings in the museum, they would pick up in the conversation. They didn't just stand there like stone, you know, so that the visitor got the impression that we were all knowledgeable about it.
Right.
But whenever there was a question, they would defer to me. What would that be, Jim? And I'd say, well, that would be about 1800, something like that.
Because you and your dad were the ones
that discussed. That's right. So he would call me down to the office, and he'd say, I'm thinking of buying this from a photograph, or I have just bought this. And he'd have someone come in helping them unwrap it or unpack it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would point out to me in that picture, let's say it was an alchemist, a big print of an alchemist. He would point out to me what was going on in that picture and how that, you remember, he'd say, that, you remember that looks by, so just like the one we had by Van Heemskerk. And I'd say,
right.
Yes, and that one has a so-and-so in it. And I'd say, that's right.
Right.
So we'd have this discussion about that work.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, if it was going to be hung, say, in the museum later on, or if it was going to be hung on the wall somewhere, it ought to be framed, because it's the only way to really kind of keep them. And he'd say, do you think it ought to be framed? I'd say, yes, I think I do. And he'd say, well, take care of that. So I would take care of it, remove it, bring it up to my office, and then I would, do, of course, take it to a framer, and we'd talk about the right mat, or no mat, and the right...
Right.
And it would come back, and Dad would approve it, and then it would be dispatched and it would go into somebody's office, or maybe it would later would go into the museum. Depends. You'd have to take something down because the museum was full.
Right.
There are pictures, by the way, Marge, of the museum in action. There's people standing around. There's a little picture of it in this recap.
Is there?
And it wasn't a big room, but it was. It had indirect lighting and a carpet.
There's a photograph in one of the brochures of the museum, I recall.
Mm-hmm.
I remember what it looked like. It was very elegant.
They had louvers and not louvers, but sort of beams and lights between them. So when you looked up, you didn't see light. You just saw the effect of light.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty hot stuff for its time.
Thank you.
For its period, it was.
Yeah. You know, when you built the museum, where did you get the ideas about designing the gallery? Because it's really...
An architect who redesigned the offices and the kitchen and the Pasteur room, and a close friend of mine named Curry, C-U-R-R-Y, had that as his assignment in doing over the 1946 building. I'm not sure. I don't think the museum was absolutely original in the 1946 edition. I'm pretty sure it wasn't. But shortly after that, it was necessary to make some substantial changes inside the building. And that's when we did this. I remember. We needed more space. So we built a balcony over part of an open area that gave us some more rooms off the balcony. And at the end of the balcony, suspended in a kind of a super balcony, was the new kitchen, cafeteria, Pasteur Memorial, and museum. So we got out of air. We created new floor space. And that's when Mr. Curry, his personal friend, now dead, who was my age, he was much younger, and so was I. And he was that kind of thinking. He did contemporary style.
Yeah, it looks
that
very
was,
nice.
That was his
he
style.
Better pictures than I
he didn't do classic architecture at all in any job he ever did. He just wasn't that style.
Mm-hmm.
So he gave us something that was quite with it for the time.
I'm not surprised by it. It's very sharp.
Yeah, it would pass today for a very crisp looking.
Yes, exactly.
Place. He also did some very clever things. He called upon him to help relay out the main office, which was on the same floor when he was in the older building. And he painted all in the columns bright orange. You know, you normally paint offices cream, white, or.
Sure.
I Rest Green, which is invented by the Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company, PPG, and they sold trainloads of I Rest Green, very, very light green, but it was not like these walls are cream, which gets dull. So you had this nice, soft green in the busy office that was supposed to be restful, nice and restful. So we had miles of I Rest Green. And Grant said, this is no way to run an office. That was Curry. So he came in and he designed it, and he'd have a column, and he'd have strong, strong blue on 1/4 of a square column. And on the opposite side of the square column, he'd have bright orange. And in between, it would be a cream or something. Well, you'd be surprised the effect it had on people working in the office. There was a new pep. There's a new zip to the office.
Great.
Those were the days. So that's how we got into that. Most of his friends were only aware dimly of the collection. Dad
it was there
had
for
the,
his pleasure. It was his pleasure, and he didn't. That was.
But at the very same time, he saw the public relations dimension.
Yes. Yeah.
It was truly a tandem concept for Dad. It was his heart love It was the only business he ever owned and ran in his whole life. It was his whole life, outside of his family, of course. And so he combined this collection to honor scientists of all ilk. And at the same time, it was a magnificent public relations device for the company. Without being crude or too forward or too commercial, it was the world's most subtle sort of thing. You know, the big pharmaceutical companies picked that idea up. Now, I don't know that they picked it up from Fisher, but somehow in the 50s, the big pharmaceutical companies began to either reproduce works of art of physicians and surgeons, which they offered in high-class reproductions to physicians, or they had them made by very skillful, what amounts to poster artists.
Commission.
Can be very good. Commission.
Mm-hmm.
A poster artist is just short of a fine art. Mm-hmm. And many have made the transition.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the physician sitting by the bedside and the sick child, the anxious parents over
right.
at the side, and a candle perhaps, because we're looking at 1870.
A comfort image.
Yeah, and then below, produced through the generosity of Upjohn Corporation, mm-hmm. or Eli Lilly, or Park Davis, mm-hmm. or all of these old-time pharmaceutical companies.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing is honoring the physician, who's their customer, because these are all prescription drugs, you know, for the most part, and doing public relations, you see, at the same time. So it's not unique in the world. Ed was early, very early.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's unique to the Fisher industry, our kind of industry either. And I just gave an example, but
very good.
That's why he did it, and it was very, very successful. Now, we'll have to talk to others about some of these questions.
Yeah, like other museums that borrowed the collection. I mean, we know that the Carnegie did, and that the
yes.
Franklin Institute did.
I'm not sure that those were... they may be the only two venues.
Really?
Now, there were some Fisher Scientific venues, but that was in company. When we opened a couple of branches in order to try and make an event to get people to come, because it really was a warehouse and an office. With about one exception, they were not manufacturing plants. They weren't, you know, you build a big box. I mean, literally, you build mm-hmm. a big box. You fill it with cases of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you have an office of 10 or 15 people. And that's all you need. And mm-hmm. bingo, you're in business in mm-hmm. St. Louis and...
Mm-hmm.
Houston and Atlanta and Silver Spring, Maryland and Medford near Boston, and I could go on and on and on. We opened 30 of them or something. And not always, but when you wanted an event, you might take selections and have them temporarily wrapped by furniture movers with these big blankets. And then the whole van, the whole truck would go to the site, and then
right.
you'd have people there and they'd unload it.
Right.
And then you'd have temporary walls set up from rental agencies, as you know, you can for weddings and receptions and whatever. And then you'd hang these things. And so you had either half of the office or maybe none of the office and a piece of the warehouse, which were, you know, nice, clean, brightly lit, brand new, concrete floor, all that
right.
sort of stuff.
Right.
With the collection. And then you'd have punch, usually, you're trying to get around the alcohol problem. You need to have cocktails, but you have non-alcohol punch and non-alc punch for those who want it. It's sort of small sandwiches and a nice invitation.
A little reception for the opening of the building.
You'd get 200-300 people, and you'd get publicity. And it was a way of saying to the people in that area, we're here now. It was much more important in those days because you didn't have online and stuff, you see. today it doesn't make any difference. You pick up the phone, you dial a number, and you don't care if stuff
where
is in Kansas
is.
City.
Yeah,
it's going to be...
Right, right, very different.
Oh, totally different business. Physical presence of being in these towns was catastrophe for competition. They were already there. But in comes this big guy with this huge national inventory and a way to connect his inventory and a monster advertising PR, publicity, direct mail, catalog program. It was tough. I mean, it really...
So you're saying that the impact of your arrival was not... well received by, or it was well received
by the competitor.
Yeah, well, by the
they
competitor.
Must have been, that's
no.
what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm talking only about competitors.
But the
only.
But the city, the town itself is probably delighted to have you.
More jobs.
Yeah.
Every town loves jobs.
Yeah.
Every city says, "Oh, the Baba's going to open here. I don't care who it is."
Right.
I mean, except a brothel maybe, but I mean, everybody says, "Joe, we're glad to have the ABC company come here. It's another 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 jobs."
Right.
Well, they always know the competitor was a guy that ground his teeth. And that, plus the two-year catalog, just finished him. Just, I mean, it was brutal. It really was brutal. I don't think it was good. I don't think in any way it was illegal. But it was just...
So did you usually end up buying the company?
Many. 20 or 30.
Mm-hmm.
And you carried the name for a little bit. And, you know, for 6 months on the phone, when they'd ask for so-and-so, they were all trained how to answer it. And you lost very few. You don't know how much you lost because you can't measure it.
But right, right.
You lost very little.
Right.
And all the branches took hold. But that was one of one way to use a different venue for the collection. And then, as you say, the Franklin Institute... And at Carnegie Museum of Art here in town, they had some free time, and the director prevailed on us to lend, I don't know, maybe 30 works of art or something like that.
We're looking to find, there was a book, a catalog of that. You don't happen to have it, do you?
You can see the state of my office.
Because if you do, we're going to try to get one from them in case they should happen to have an extra one, but it seems unlikely.
Well,
so we would like to find one.
The director of the Museum of Art is a close personal friend and have helped him in many ways. He, me, Richard Armstrong. I don't know where he is today, but his office, I can call ahead and tell them you're coming, and they'll do anything they can for you. I mean, the nicest sort of people, and Richard Armstrong will know that he wants to give instructions to Miss Gap is coming, give her anything she wants. That's all it takes.
I think they're more pinched. They physically don't have another job.
Did they tell you that?
It was a long time.
Oh yeah, well, he said before.
The chances are they don't.
She did look. She looked, and then they called me back and said.
I didn't know you got called.
Well, okay, there aren't any. It wouldn't surprise me. You know, a major museum has 3 or 4 changing exhibits a year. And so since then, it would be 100 in 25 years.
And they don't usually have space to keep more than one copy of those things.
No, they don't.
Well, I work at the Philadelphia Museum as well.
Which museum?
The Philadelphia Museum.
Oh, I see.
And we have all these catalogs.
You see the same problem.
We have tons of old catalogs in the back of the office, but that doesn't mean every institution has this much.
Well, when you print a catalog for a big show, you always guess. I'm on the committee, the budget committee, on the museum, and all of those sort of things, and on the board. And you know, you say you're going to print 2,000 or 6,000. These are expensive catalogs. And you have no idea how it's going to sell. I mean, you either run out or you have them left over. You just can't be right.
Yeah.
And then when you get all through and it's all done and it's a year later and all, what you do, and you run out of storage space, you say, well, let's keep a dozen. Because we just can't.
Right.
And you push all the rest out into the market, and there's a faint, faint, faint aftermarket out there, and they go for a buck or two someplace.
Right.
Little shops all over the country. And they vanish. They evaporate. So, I don't know.
Well, did your dad have an art collection, an art book collection? Did he collect art books?
He never was interested in art.
No.
Never. David's mother. They were totally untutored. Totally untutored in the field of art. They did the right thing, and the Americans did. You went abroad, you went to the art museums, far more than you went to art museums in the United States. I don't think Mother ever was in an art museum in the United States in her life. And she went to X, Y, and Z in Europe because it was the thing to do. It's what Americans did. You couldn't go to Paris without going to the Louvre. And you can't help but be impressed with what you're looking at, but you don't really know what you're looking at. There was no real appreciation of art, the history of art, fine art, knowledge of art at home. We had a fine painting in the dining room of a 18th century army officer, a cavalry officer, and a fine white horse, beautiful painting, big, beautiful painting over the fireplace in the dining room. But I don't think anybody had a clue as to who painted or who the subject was. But it was a beautiful thing. And it was a scene of Venice in the living room, which was a certain style of a mirror below, probably was bigger in its day, where you had a giant mirror and a panel above, which is a very, when ceilings were tall in the old days. And that was a very common form of decorative arts. Mm-hmm. And you get a good artist to paint a scene. Mm-hmm. And Venice, of course, is the perennial favorite, because it's the sentimental favorite,
right.
Classical favorite. And we had the upper half of a very lovely panel, a mirror below with an antique mirror in it. The kids would look at the antique mirror and you'd see it was kind of speckled and imperfect and... because glass making was imperfect and mirror making was imperfect. And above it was this beautiful scene of Venice. And we knew it as Venice because Mother and Dad said, that's Venice. That's what it was. But that was about all. So there really wasn't... there wasn't much. There was an itinerant artist who painted my great-great-grandmother, and I have it at home, a Scots-Irish woman with the false teeth and a stern face and a bonnet. It's painted about 1810 by an itinerant artist. It's a good painting, really, but we don't know who it is, but it's been handed down.
Right.
That's the sort of stuff in the house. It wasn't fine art. Dad never collected fine art. I mean, he could have bought, God, you know, the history. He was a man of some means in the 40s and 50s. 30s, of course, were tough going. The Great
right.
Depression lasted
right.
all through the 30s. And but even in the 20s, he was, relative to his time, he was a well-to-do man. And we lived quite well. And you could have bought Picasso for $200, $300.
Sure.
Painters of that period, Miro and, I'm just trying to think of the 20s, but for nothing. They just hadn't been discovered. Stuff that goes for 1, 2, 3, 5 million today. Hindsight's great.
Well, I mean, he bought what he bought was great for us.
He did. He bought this stuff and all out of his own money, as I said.
Is there seems to be a very tight span when you really purchased most of his paintings. But do you remember it being more spread out?
Well, he continued to collect until he died in 65. I would say he collected up to about 1960. He began to have some health problems. My recollection of I bought from a few things from about 55 through 1960 through about 1975, because when an offering came, it more likely came to me, or it came to Dad and he would send it to me. And you'd look at the offering and you'd think, well, sometimes it's almost a dupe of something we already have, and you'd thank the man. Or it was something new. or it was a trip that was a little bit different than the one we had. We'd go and look at the one, and yeah, I think it was $100. And let's get it.
Right.
So we had hundreds of those.
Right.
And if you couldn't get any of that, sometimes you'd say, well, we'll tell you what we'll do, we'll pay you for a photograph. And right. then some of these people, having already been turned down on the sale, would foolishly say, all right, and, you know, $25 or $50 and we'll send you a photograph. So we had a lot of photographs. But it was a relatively short period. And don't forget, a big chunk of the collection was the Pope collection. You know about that. Boy. You see, that gave it one chunk.
Is there a list of what was included in the Pope collection? That probably material that went to the company and you're saying is lost, but do you yourself think that there would be?
I think John at the local company.
Because that would be invaluable.
When you came in from the airport, you went by.
Did we?
A business complex, a suburban business complex, roughly halfway between the airport and the city. A big office buildings. You know, the standard procedure, get out of the city. And they're there.
That's where John is.
And that's where John. And he could answer whether he has a list of what was in the Pope collection in his files.
That would be very helpful.
I could have thought he might have turned it over to you guys, to Philadelphia.
The only thing we got was a Xerox copy of Chester Fisher's notes, you know, with his notebook, and that does have a lot of information, but it doesn't, it's not original, and some of it's hard to read, and it's not really documents.
Well,
it's
we
like
can
his
ask
notes.
John. It's easy to ring John and see if he's there, and not call him another time. And he's 5 miles from there. And Harry would know. Harry wouldn't have any records. He might have a memory. I'm almost certain there was a list.
I'm sure there was.
I'm sure there was. And you know the story on that. He had a man bid on an auction, you know, and he sent it over to ship torpedo and came back to China again. And this time it made it. And now that was not in number, but in quality. That was a very huge impetus to the collection.
Yeah.
It equaled the fine stuff that Dad already had. So in the fine stuff, essentially kind of doubled. But it did not have all this collateral information only stuff, with copies of prints and photographs.
It wasn't prints as well. Mm-hmm.
It was only
paintings.
It was engravings fine paintings. And
right.
They were really fine works in the Pope. There was none. He collected on a dual scale. He collected, obviously, the history of science, but he also had a threshold of. He was not interested in a $5 copy of something for the heck of it because it was of interest and he could use it for advertising. That wasn't his. He was an eminent scientist.
Right.
Chemist.
Cambridge.
And, I collect for interest. That stuff. Some of that stuff is photographs of maps because I couldn't get them. But it has a theme. The theme is the history of Western Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh. So I have lots of that, but they're not worth $5.
It's the content.
I'm collecting for different reasons.
Right, right.
So you're right. There was quite a spurt at that one point. And then
this is during the war, though.
Well, you didn't get much offering during the war because most people. Most dealers would have surmised that there was no way to ship it.
Yeah.
You know, shipping the war from 39 to 45, the North Atlantic was just a minefield. It was called an ocean, but it really was a minefield. And how that shipment ever got through, I have no idea.
Yeah.
The only thing I can think of is that the U-boats had a limited number of torpedoes. Why torpedo a ship coming going west? I wasn't carrying any supplies to England. The United States, of course, kept England alive in the bed, you know, without it. And it would have been all over. Because we would have had no staging ground for the invasion. Maybe, you know, in the long, long, long run, the United States and its allies would have won that war, but it was a completely different scenario. So my guess is that you got a ship going west, and the undersea boat captain would say, why waste the torpedo on that? We're trying to get them going the other way.
What if we have German POWs?
Yes, it conceivably could. But it didn't have munitions and food and all the stuff that kept England alive. So. And of course, it was going west with the freight. So and then, there you go. Yeah. I don't know why it was torpedoed the first time.
It's bizarre.
And we don't even know for sure that it was torpedoed. We know the ship was damaged. It could have been a shot.
Or a mine.
It could have been a mine. It could have been a submarine that surfaced and figured, well, we'll give it one shell. Yeah. And if it turns and runs, we're not going to chase it. The fuel is limited.
Right.
They had about a 75 millimeter gun on deck. Yeah. And you give it one wham and injure it? And
it had fuel, of course, if it blew up.
Yeah, and it, but it didn't go up. It went, got back to port somewhere.
Good for us.
It's a funny story. Harry Schwab told that story for years before audiences all over the United States. And he ended that part of it by saying, and you can imagine the joy in Pittsburgh when the shipment arrived, which is even more surprising since we're 300 miles from the coast. And the audience were all because that's the kind of way he told stories, you know. And Harry is a great storyteller.
Yeah, I haven't met him, but I've heard about his
storytelling. What he doesn't know, he makes up.
I guess, what do you know about the Harmony Society, Old Economy Village? Do you know anything about your father's relationship with them?
I wasn't aware of any.
Okay.
We know what it is. It's a early 19th century, late 19th century village set up around a religious concept centering, like the Mormons, around a certain religious leader,
right,
who moved west for inexpensive land and the right to build and live as he and his followers wanted in every style. And the theme was self-sufficiency.
Right.
You grew everything you ate. You made everything by hand you needed. You made your tools by with what? I don't know. But you made your tools with tools you had made. I mean, where it starts.
And evidently they were preparing for a second coming, which they thought
second coming, as to a certain degree of the Mormons.
Right.
It's wrapped up with a religious concept. And it's in Economy, Pennsylvania, which is down the Ohio River. It's about a 45-minute drive from Pittsburgh on the Ohio, and it's now open to the public, Williamsburg-style village museum.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, not so much reconstructed as Williamsburg is, to a great degree. It's almost totally original, because it's much younger than Williamsburg.
Yeah.
And to historians of various types, it's extremely interesting. It doesn't happen to be a particular great interest to me. I'm interested in the history of the area, but it could have been in Ohio. It is not a history of this city. It's only a dim part of the connection of the history of this city, which was a fort, and that the triangulation of the river was you know, Lewis and Clark started their trip here and went all the way to the Pacific. You know, this city has a whole lot of importance of itself, not just a steel center, but as a transportation, and George Washington came here three times, was shot at, and then killed. once left with three holes in his jacket from bullets. I mean, yeah, it wouldn't have made George Washington. It's loaded with American history, this triangle.
Right. Well, evidently, the director, Raymond Shepard, has records that your father gave some laboratory, old alchemical laboratory equipment to this museum.
Well, I didn't know that, and I would be very, very doubtful if it's alchemical equipment.
Maybe it's
I never had
equipment.
Any idea, a concept that we ever had any alchemical material.
Hmm.
We do have a little bit in the collection of Pasteur material, but you understand that's a whole lot later.
That's a different.
A whole lot later.
That's totally different.
The alchemical period, the height was about 1640, 50, 60 in that period, or even earlier. It really wouldn't have any collection with the economy, the village, because that was much later. And so you're telling me something about which I know nothing.
I
never heard of it. And I'd been there, and it wouldn't necessarily mean that it wasn't there and I didn't see it, but I never even heard about it. I never thought to ask. And I doubt if it was alchemical material. Now, it's conceivable that he might have come across some apparatus of about the period when that was founded from some collector.
Well,
and had no real need for it, there being no Fisher Museum at that time. So he might have said, what am I going to do with this? See, I'm just conjecturing.
Some earlier chemical equipment, yeah.
Just about the time of the old economy, which was 1800 or something like that, wasn't it? About that.
Right.
So he might have said, well, this is 1800 stuff, and I don't know what to do with it.
Could be.
And he very well might have given it to them. That's I'm just conjecturing.
Right.
But that's news to me that we have any connection with that place, other than an interest in museums.
Right.
I belong to a local association I don't. I'm on two museum boards, and they're members of a 60 museum group, the Greater Pittsburgh Museum Council, which is four counties, museums of all kinds, every kind. Historical art, science, planetariums, zoos, aquaria, there's an old trolley museum, there's blah, 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 everything. And we belong to a loose federation.
Consortium.
And through that, and old economy is part of that.
Is part of that, yes. Well, they evidently had some paintings that they no longer own, and so I guess he was also speculating as to whether or not paintings, and evidently there was a Teniers, there were two small pictures by David Teniers. So he wondered whether or not they had been sold to Fisher. I mean, this is all speculation also. And
well, I can't help you. And has someone talked to the director there?
I have spoken to the director there, and he knows no more about it than what I've just told you.
We run into a blank wall then, because I can't shed any light on that subject. The David Teniers that we have in the collection, which is now becoming the Heritage Foundation, is everyone that I ever had any contact with. Now, your friend that Aldrich, he might have had that, because it was kind of a favorite topic of Teniers. The younger, because he was a genre painter, and as Bruegel and others, and you know the village scenes, the rustic scenes, the country wedding, the farmer's picnic, those sort of things, and that's why he painted The Alchemist, because it was he was a very interesting old geezer in the village. He was is part of the scene of the old village, as Van Gogh painted the postman. It's the standard, not royalty, but the postman. You see what I mean? It was a different way of
looking. And he's a close follower of Brouwer, who is a close imitator, very close, with Unbroken Chain. Purdue for up to 15 years.
Right.
But he is very, I mean, his scenes are much more, I think, somber and dignified.
Oh, yes, because Broder was raucous. Yeah. Not like nothing better than the company picnic or what, and the girls are being chased and the trousers are being pulled off and everything in the world's going on in those pictures. And, you know, they're really very raunchy.
Yes,
as was the period.
Yeah. That's important to remember.
Yeah. He was a genre painter, and he was photographing, in a way, what was going on.
Recording, yes.
Yeah. And that was what was going on. It was a lusty period. It just lacked the reserve. It came in much later under...
set. We had done one cassette before this, sides A and B, and this is side A of the second cassette. The question was, how did CG hear about the collection, the Pope collection? His dealer in London told CG, probably by cable, which is what you did in those days, that there was an auction. And the way I heard the story from Dad is he authorized, and maybe there was an estimate in the dealer's cable. There almost always is. You know, estimate this collection might go for so many pounds. And Dad authorized the dealer to bid up to X, whatever that was. And by George, he got it. And it apparently was quite close. And he felt very lucky about it because the war being on and so much other more important news, the scientific community of Great Britain was probably hardly aware of even Pope's death, far less the collection, far less the auction.
Sure.
So, as Dad sort of said with pride, the Yankees did it again. They stole in at night and took this collection out from under the night, because I'm absolutely certain that the scientific societies of Great Britain would have made some kind of a move to stop that and set up some kind of a collection and museum or whatever.
Sure.
But they didn't, and he was smart to grab it when he did, and he got it, and he got it on the bid, and you know, he could have been the underbidder and he wasn't. And in those days, who knows? You send a cable over, it was a couple of days, and you get it back. It isn't like these telephone bids at Sotheby's, and
right.
You get somebody on the phone, and then you get the collection, and you get somebody in Australia, and he says, I'll go another 10,000, and he goes like this, and it's another, you know, they don't
right.
do that those days.
Right.
And I have a copy here of a priceless cablegram from Andrew Carnegie when he paid the money to build an extension on his famous building, which will be in this afternoon, contains a museum of natural history, a music hall, a lecture hall, and Canadian Museum of Art, all in one building. It all grew out of the library, which is the original. And there's a beautiful hall of architecture, which has plaster casts, which went out of favor and come back now, and we have some magnificent plaster casts. And right next to it is a hall of sculpture. The sculpture surrounded, it's a copy of the Parthenon on a smaller scale. It's a really fascinating building, a room, the balcony around the way the Parthenon originally did, and of course, and many statues. And the question was whether, by the architect, whether the statues should be closed or not. And knowing Carnegie, he was wise enough to ask, because Carnegie could be very generous, but he could also be very opinionated. So Carnegie sent back a telegram that said, regarding cablegram, recommend statues be clothed, as indeed they are in all respectable museums except London, sighed Carnegie. Now, the joke, of course, is that he was Scottish, and the rivalry between the Scots and the London. And London was the center of all evil. It was the center of sin, you see, to a Scotsman born in Dunfermline, the 1,200 population, or whatever it was, 2,000, had been there. And so the unclothed figure, oh, it was just lewd automatically because it was. So that's the cablegram that did in those days. I have a copy of that cablegram, and I did a presentation right for the 100th anniversary of the founding, and we had an actor playing Carnegie and all, and he read that line, and we had a packed audience in the music hall. It must have had 1,500 people, and they just roared. And when we rehearsed it, I said to this actor, it was simply marvelous. And you're going to, like you say to a comedian in a play, you're going to pause here because you're going to get a laugh here. He says, really? I said, yes, you will. And he paused, and it was a heck of a laugh. Because you can't hear the next line if you don't hear.
Sure.
So anyway, that's how we heard about it. And you heard the story of how it got here.
Yeah.
And you know how we used the collection.
Oh, here's something I've been wondering about. You had spoken to me about all of the film footage, the movies, the home movies that your father took when you were traveling.
That is all now at the Pittsburgh Filmmakers, which is, I guess, the number one, it's close to the number one filmmaking training center in the country. It's run by a great nephew of mine named Charlie Humphrey, who's a ball of fire, basket of energy. And he looked at a closet at my house one day on request, and there were hundreds.
I remember you.
And he rolled his eyes, and I said, I will have these all delivered to you, because among his programs he has slave labor, because you can get your degree there now in connection with a couple of the local universities. And it's like the intern in the medical world. It's kind of semi-slave labor. You work your 80 hours a week and you get $100 a month. But the brave man said, send it and I'll start through it. And he has it and he's starting through it. And I had a call here just a couple days ago saying that he had started, and I guess at some point this winter I will stop in and see how far he's gotten. But it's got a little bit of everything, and I'm sure it's got me in short pants sliding down a slide or on a swing, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, there are two things here. One is that images of you and your family that are casual, that could be turned into images that we could have in our archives.
Sure.
We would be interested in that. Your father, you, your family, your mother, your brothers. And secondly, the visit to the Pasteur Institute and any footage inside your father's workplaces, things that would be images like that. Do you remember if he took a photograph of the laboratory in the Pasteur Institute, for instance? That would be incredible to have for our archives. Those are the types of things
I don't recollect either my taking pictures inside the laboratory.
But
when
you did
went through it
of mice
with our little guide,
the little old man.
My brother, who's 4 years older, Ben, because he had the original tiny little 8mm booby camera made by Kodak, which you could get into a pocket. It was a pretty good sized pocket. But the speed of the film would be such that I would be very doubtful if you could take anything inside. You need an awful lot of light.
Yes, you're right.
It was color film, and you wouldn't have the speed for film.
Yes.
Now, he did take the, and you have a copy of it, he did take a movie of Joseph Meister outside when we went to leave.
Right.
Standing at the gate, and we took one frame.
Out of that.
And that frame made that print.
Right. But that print
and that print was taken outside at the gate.
Yes.
At which he later shot himself.
Right.
In probably 1936.
Right.
I believe that was all. I don't think he was taken inside. Now, the Pasteur Institute, which is, by the way, the way you pronounce it, is pronounced just exactly as stir your coffee, because it's French. Pasteur Institute in Paris, where I was a couple years ago, has a lot of prints of the lab as it was when he worked there. You know, mm-hmm. He died in 1890 or something. This is quite newer. This is a whole lot newer than the alchemists. Up to fairly recently, they left the labs as they were.
I remember you telling me that.
They have now changed that, and they have all his glassware and whatnot in a mini museum in cases, big glass cases, many, many, many of them, glass shelves. And you can spend a couple hours in there looking at these things. And they have photographs of a lot of that stuff, and they have photographs of the labs as they originally were when he died. shortly thereafter, because they kept them that way for a long time. And there is a lot of space in an adjunct building that is not currently used research medical laboratories for records, documents, books, correspondence, everything. And that place is just crawling with opportunities to get stuff on Pasteur. That's all. That's all they do.
Which I think that we would be interested in. But in the context of what I'm speaking of, I'm interested in what is related to you and your father, and any kind of imagery, film footage that you know you would want to give to us.
I don't know what's in there. I doubt. It's going to be fascinating if this stuff that's at the filmmaker reveals the film from which the one frame. The reason I say astounding, because it seems to me that that one film on 8mm film, an 8mm film, which is,
but
it didn't get put back with all the other stuff. My guess is that once it got out, took it to somebody in town.
Because that's a
You make a print of this?
That print, I think, is from something that was produced in a newspaper or a magazine, because it has a dot matrix. And so,
then the film may be gone, and the original was
may have left.
Now, the farthest back that I can go is that same picture, maybe with a dot matrix, and maybe not. Hung in the Pasteur Memorial, which is this mini little dining room, which was dimly lit for atmosphere, with walnut walls and stuff for atmosphere. And if I had had a strong light, I would have known, and also younger eyes, whether that was indeed clipped from something which had been printed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very possible it was printed, because it might have been reproduced in one of our magazines.
That's what it looks like, yeah.
Harry would know more about that than I.
Okay.
I would despair of thinking that we had the film.
Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. Because
the 8mm film. I'm sure we have some that are sent out to filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because that was a cutesy idea, a little camera that was so light you could almost put it in an overcoat pocket. And my brother Ben was a great photographer. He took a lot of pictures. He loved taking pictures. And a lot of family stuff is in there. Whether that particular film, because it had that historical little old man, is unlikely, because my guess would be that that film would be found.
It would have been used.
Now, maybe, you know, maybe it may be that film is in this pile, which
that
is
would
a,
be nice.
Which is a station wagon load full of stuff.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
But and what we had in the museum was cut from a publication.
But equally, I mean, I'm interested in that, but I'm also interested in some more candid shots of your father.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be
know.
Fantastic.
I can't answer that.
Right.
And I'm going to go this winter out to Charlie and
we'll just keep it in mind.
Go through what we got out there and keep this in mind when I see there. Now, a lot of that stuff would be my family. My family. When I was first married in 53. Not Dad's family.
I see.
Yes. But it's a mixture.
Okay.
A lot of still stuff. To a lot of 35mm.
We'll keep it in mind.
35mm camera. It's very, very popular with a very inexpensive camera. Called the Argus was 35mm camera. $20 or something. And it just sold like hotcakes. It was the successor to the original Kodak Brownie. But it was for 35mm film. So you crank it up and you get 36 exposures
right.
on it.
Right.
And the grain got closer, so you could get a lot of detail on a small film.
Yeah.
And that was Brother Ben had a dark room in the house and developed a lot of his own pictures. Off the laundry. The laundry in the cellar of this big old house, and it was a tiny little grubby room. I don't know what the world was ever built for. They had a little tiny sink in it. And he'd put tape on the walls and climb in there with the hypo and close the door, and the place smelled of
Right.
And took the pictures, and you took a lot of pictures.
I was there.
You were there? You're not old enough.
No, no, no.
You did that.
We did this in our parents' basement.
Did you?
Took your friends to read. Your
high phone, remember the high phone?
Yeah.
My husband's a photographer and does black and white photography. Greg does.
Do you still have that in your house?
Yeah, we have a dark room on the third floor.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I can remember being in there with him as much younger and smaller. We're getting squeezed together. A little tiny red bulb goes into it, and then he opened the phone and dunked it.
Right, right.
And then at some point, you know, he put it in the tray with a stick, and hoop it around, and then get it up and get it into the high pop. And it's about as far from the digital camera as you can get.
Yeah. No kidding.
Oh. And my wife still teaches the kids how to do black and white photography with an enlarged.
Does she? Is that what she teaches?
You will see at the Canadian Museum of Art. We have right now a simply fabulous black and white collection being shown by called Dream Street, which is the name of the street, by Smith, the great American photographer.
We saw that on the website, and we are looking forward to seeing it.
Oh, it's a fabulous picture. It's surprising in small pictures. Mm-hmm. But that's, you just stand a little closer.
Right.
And his eye for the moment and the angle are just superb. And it's on display at the museum. And before I forget it, I got a couple passes for you.
Oh.
There's no point in paying admission.
Oh. Are these in the tray? There's two in the tray.
Oh, here they are.
Yeah, good for you. Take
thank
those.
You. Oh, thank that's you. Really kind of you.
Take those because, by the way, that's a joint admission. We won't have time, but he one admission lets you in both the Museum of Natural History and the Museum of Art, and you have reason to want to go to one or the other. But there's one admission because people wander between them in this building. There's no possible way to leave and have, for other reasons we do it. But pecker count.
Oh, yes.
But that same person may walk back out again and go to the other museum and so forth. I'm sorry about this.
Fisher. No problem.
Hello. Can't talk to you, J-Bo. Where are you? Okay, give me your number. How long are you going to be there? Give me the number again. Got it? 581. Gotcha. Call you. What else could I tell you?
I think we've got a
pretty good
job.
Record. I hope your record takes proper cognizance of the part that Paul Montrone played in bringing about what the Chemical Heritage Foundation has. That he was absolutely key because he didn't really, and this is perfectly understandable, didn't really know what he had.
Right.
He was still trying to find out what he had in the company, never mind about this oddball collection. It wasn't his cup of tea. He wasn't part of it from way, way back. The fact that he was born and raised in Philadelphia helps. Because it was...
I didn't know that.
Well, you do now.
Well, thank you.
But it helps because it was sort of bringing it home to his hometown. But through a long period of education, if you will, he began to understand what he had. And so many things could have happened to it that didn't.
Yes.
We had one close call after the other.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And
you were working
Arnold
for
and I
years.
Worked hand in glove. I mean,
yes.
Arnold and I talked every week for months, we talked every week about how to teach Paul what we had and what it was and where it ought to go and why it should be kept together and why it should go to Philadelphia and why the company should give it and just on and on and on and on. And I would write to Paul and he would write to Paul and then he would we did all kinds of things, including when you did those extensive renovations at your place of business in Philly. We built the gallery before we had the collection. I say we as if I was part of it. But I mean,
I know that.
and we did. And then I went over there on several occasions and took pictures of the work in progress.
Yeah.
I think three occasions.
Yeah.
And then I would send the pictures to Paul and tell him I just got back from Philadelphia and that our project, is coming along nicely. And, you know, and here was Paul and what the hell is this guy talking about? And we haven't decided to we're going to do this with the pictures. But the more we did that, the more he began to building this.
Oh,
extensive renovation. Some of it wasn't for the museum, but for the collection. And finally, we got right down to the point of decision. It was very, very close. And I called him and made. I had been in his office and made the pitch, which he was astounded at. He was just taken back. And he had a couple of his assistants there, and they of course went. And he made a nod, which meant, check this out from a tax point of view. You know, one of those things any executive would.
Mm-hmm.
And they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally we got right down to the final. And I called him and I said, now, you know, Paul, we've got to make a decision on this. And I had written him and I said, we want that collection and we want $100,000 to clean it and reframe it and hang it. I've sort of been in fundraising for, I don't know, half a century. And I've learned that if you're going to give A, you don't mind giving B. If you're going to give a dormitory, and I sold a lot of them for school, then you wouldn't mind endowing it. You wouldn't want that dorm to get ready, would you, Dr. Jones? So I said, give me the collection. Give them the collection. And $100,000. And it was a long pause. He'd obviously thought about it. And he said, well, Jim, I'll tell you what. If we come up with the collection and $100,000, it seems to me appropriate that the Fisher family should come up with $100,000 too. Doesn't that seem to make sense? Well, of course, what are you going to say? No, it doesn't make sense. But you can tell why he's chief executive officer.
Yes, that was very good.
And I was ready for it.
Very good.
And I said, Paul, I believe that that can be done. I believe that can be done. So sit tight. He said, all right, I'll sit tight. Well, the family has what amounts to a foundation. It's actually a fund within the Pittsburgh Foundation, which is a catch-all. It has 800 funds in it. But one of those is the Fisher Fund. So I went to the Fisher Fund, which I was then chairman. Now it's New Generation. And told the whole story. And Dad established the foundation. So I was on firm grounds. He did that at the advice of older brother Aiken, who was always the long-sighted one. Except for the fact that he didn't get the collection out of the company sale. He could have done that. It wouldn't have made any difference to Allied at all. They didn't know what they had. So I went to that, and it was easy. It was an easy sell.
Wow.
So we got the 100.
Wow.
And I called Paul, and rather than let him forget what he had done, I interpreted his conversation with me as an absolute promise. I'll give you A if you give me B. He didn't quite say that, but and I said, Paul, we've met your match. The deal is done. And there was a pause, and he realized that. I said, I got the 100 to match your 100, and we'll arrange, you'll be hearing from Arnold and his gang and so forth. And then we had a couple more words, and that was the end of it.
Wonderful.
He kind of hung up and wondered, what have I done? Because I think that was the way to do it. You know, I didn't want him to deliberate and talk to his accountant some more and talk to his lawyers some more and talk to anybody and let John Pavlik, who is the curator here, talk. Because John was heartbroken that he lost this. And he had him in the office in this place halfway to the airport. They had about 3 visitors a year to see it compared to where you guys are. It's just way out of the way. The company headquarters is in New Hampshire, you know.
I know.
It's not there. Well, it's divided. One division is here.
We still have a good relationship with Fisher Scientific International. We're working with them on a 100-year anniversary exhibit, I understand.
Great.
I think that they're still very close to them. Hope to go back to them for more support.
Well, that's good. I'm delighted you are. And, of course, you have the 100th anniversary of the company coming up, which is 1902. And I'm going to find for you. I think we're through with the tape. What else can I give you on the tape?
I think we might be through with the tape. I have some show and tell for you, though.
Uh-huh. And I have something I'm digging for, but we need to use tape time for that.
Okay.
I've got too many pots going at once.
Yeah. Well, you want to turn the tape off?
Yeah, we'll turn it off. We'll turn the tape off.